across the cornfields where the woods got heavy. Out in the back seat of my 60 Chevy, working on mysteries without any clues. Working on a night move.
720 WGN, it is Dane here with you, high atop Chicago in the Skyline studio, and I'll be with you until 4 a.m. tonight, and we have got a great eclectic blend, but a great show on tap for you. No pun intended. We're going to talk a little bit about the world of food and wine. We're going to talk a little racing. We're going to talk a little comedy. We are going to highlight some of the great things that are happening out there, and excited to have you all on board for that as well. Murr from Practical Jokers is going to be on with us. We're going to have the author of the book, the new one about John Andretti. He will be with us, Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian. Donald Davidson is going to be with us as well. Dr. Ernst Lohsen is going to be calling us from the Moselle region of Germany to talk a little bit about the wines that they have going on there. And Scotty Johnson is going to be joining us, barbecue world champion. Will be on with us. Stay tuned for that coming up. Without further ado, excited, always excited whenever I can have this guy on the line. He is one of the leading voices in the world of wine, best-selling author, headlining food and wine personality, and now he has become the Don King of the wine cask with his blockbuster battle coming up. The one and only Mark Oldman, welcome to the show.
I'm so happy to be here, Dane. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is. It's great to have you. Anytime there's an opportunity to get a chance to talk to you, I feel that we are doing a service for the public and a service for the listeners. You know, outside of your normal, I don't want to say comfort zone, because you're comfortable in all kind of aspects and areas of what you do, to be able to kind of break down and give people a little bit more Mark Oldman in another setting, I think is really cool. We're going to have an opportunity to have a little bit of an extended conversation. I think we should take advantage of it. And so many people see what it is that you do on the book side. You know, there may be a paragraph or two on the front flap of the book, or of course they enjoy you headlining places like the Classic at Aspen or New York City Wine and Food or any of those things. And they get to have that entertainment side of Mark Oldman. They get to enjoy that. But yeah, I always wonder if people wondered, like, what makes a Mark Oldman? You've always been one of those great ambassadors, kind of demystifying wine, making it more approachable. You're one of those guys that, you know, you got to know all the rules before you can break them. But ooh, you're yeah. A humble guy, too. And for the listeners, this is a guy who's, I think you're a three-time Stanford grad, right? And I think that you are the founder of the Stanford Wine Circle. And so for those people who wonder how you go from point A to point Mark Oldman, talk a little bit about how you either came into the world of wine or fell in love with wine. How did that connection start?
Well, you know, it reminds me of, I had a very old professor once. She was so cool. She was 95. She taught me about Camparis, and she also taught me about Australian literature. So, but she was a great woman, and she, in late in life, wrote a book on the English author, we won't even mention, minor English author, but it was on the front page of the New York Times Book Review. And so she had this great success late in life, but she used a line about the author that said, "The author never zigged or zagged more." And so I think that leads to a fun and rewarding life, that you need to zig, you need to zag, you need to have faith that the dots will connect, and sometimes just pursue your passion and then make it all make sense later. So I guess, you know, what some people get into wine to lord it over others and to have something persnickety and kind of snobby. And then other people, and these are the people I like to hang out with, are just trying to get a really delicious drink and can help people figure out a framework to find the wine that tastes really good to them. So, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. I grew up listening to Van Halen. And, by the way, I love Impractical Jokers. It's getting me through the pandemic. I know that you have the very thin guy on tonight. I forgot his name. What's his name?
James S. Murray, of course. La 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 la. So Murr is what he goes by.
Murr. Yeah, I love Murr, and I love these guys. And so, you know, I have a great appreciation for just, you know, fun stuff. And at the same time, I have tasted all the expensive wines, and I have been around all the experts and taken great, great notes. And I like to combine the two together because I want what I do in wine, and like, for example, you mentioned race car driving. I want the Mark Oldman of like racing to give me the inside scoop. That's something I would love to learn about, but we don't have time, unfortunately, in this all too short life to make, you know, to have like 10 hobbies. So I need the cheat sheet to a lot of things I know I would be interested in. I guess that's part of your role, Dane. You bring us these kind of glimpses into worlds, and you help us figure out if this could be more than just a passing passion.
I think having the ability to kind of lead people there and say, come on, you know, this is a safe space and I can take you there. I think it's important. Did you feel, you know, based on the educational side, obviously, you know, there are some people who would lord that over others. That's something that you would never bring up in a normal setting, but it is something I think that sets you apart. And then, of course, you know, having an affinity for Van Halen and maybe not the most highbrow comedy out there for those familiar with the Jokers. Do you feel like you need to be even maybe more on your game because of these other kind of aspects of your personality that you're proud of, right? That are maybe more pedestrian as far as that goes, that you have to be more on your game and be sharper, maybe with the wit, maybe with the humor when it comes to the wine knowledge.
You're so right. If you take the, because I think a lot of us in general are being afraid of, it's the imposter syndrome. We're afraid that we're going to be unmasked in whatever field you're in as a fraud. I think that's just a natural human emotion, unless you're sociopathic, and you know, but that's something else. But I think that a lot of wine people are afraid to loosen up around wine because they're afraid that someone's going to call them on one of the a million micro details in wine. So you're absolutely right. I'll never forget when I first started teaching about wine, I had approached one of the early wine bars in New York City. It's called the Soho Kitchen and Bar. No longer exists, but I approached the owner, and I had learned a lot about wine at college. So I'm like, you know, can I teach a wine class in your empty cabaret room upstairs? I'll do it. I'll teach it. I'll market it. You provide the people, and I'll select the wine from your list, and we'll split the profits. And we were busy. We had people coming. I called it the Soho Anti-Snob Wine Seminar. And people were coming from day one, but I'll tell you, there's nothing like having to teach a room full of New Yorkers. And by the way, my virtual wine tastings now, my wine tastings online called are $20 a shot. But back then, this was 1992, here in New York City, they were $88. Of course, that included the wine and all that. But there's nothing like a New Yorker who's paid $88 and a baby-faced recent college grad teaching them wine to make sure you are on top of your game. Because these people wanted their money's worth. And I never forgot that. You know, I know you're really into rock and roll, but another... you know, similar sentiment is Geddy Lee of Rush talked about how when they first went on tour with Kiss, it was really important for Rush to be the opening act for Kiss because Kiss, love them or hate them, they always gave the audience their money's worth. And Rush took that to heart, and that's what they learned from Kiss. So I learned early on, you have to treat every event as if you're being judged. Your whole reputation rides on that one event. So it's important for me to give people their money's worth.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing, too. We're going to take a break, and we come back. We'll have more with Mark Oldman and building in what it is. It's one thing to get the knowledge, get your money's worth, and feel like you come out of it a better person. $88 better, $20 better. But to go from fear to fun, where you are taking not only all of that important information on the wine side, but building in the entertainment side, which I think had not been done before. I think unprecedented. Keep it here. We'll have more with Mark Oldman. It's Dane on 720 WGN. 620 WGN. It is Dane here with you, high atop Chicago Skyline Studio. And just to let people know, coming up next week, Nick DiGilio is going to be back, and he'll be back with us. So excited for that. And we'll be here until 4 a.m. with you. And on the line with us now, we've got again, one of the leading voices in the world of wine, but I think one of the transcendent ones as well. There are a lot of people out there now that are trying to make wine more approachable, or maybe demystify it, or you know, make it not so scary. But there's nobody who has done kind of the extra work, kind of transcending two different levels to not only make it to where you're not afraid, but you're having a great time and building in that whole entertainment side of it. Whether it's the gold lamé jackets, reminiscent of, let's say, Elvis, or bringing in sort of the AC/DC Angus. Mark Oldman does all of that stuff. So, Mark, at what point when it came into, and you talk about some of those early kind of tough crowds that you had to work through, you had to know your stuff, where you became comfortable enough with it to say, you know what, we want to give people more than what they would expect from a wine seminar where they're going to learn from, you know, some of the best information from some of the best, you know, we want to rock these people. We want to kind of knock their socks off when you wanted to build in the entertainment side.
Exactly. And you used a great quote, you know, first you got to know the rules so you can then break them. And I think that was Pablo Picasso who said that. And so first I ended up studying wine like my life depended on it, because I had what I call Mr. Wolf. So I had these crowds of thirsty New Yorkers paying $88 a shot in 1991. And I didn't look like a bearded wine expert, you know, an old bearded goat of a wine expert. And so I really, you know, people had low expectations. So I overprepared, and I really, really learned wine that way. And then the years went by, and then I started doing these festivals. And, you know, it's like when you've got 300 people in a room, you have to do more than talk about the sugar content in wine or malolactic fermentation. You have to sit back and think, okay, how can I deliver, how can I, not sugarcoat, but how can I deliver great little nuggets of knowledge, but keep people's attention, make them laugh? I mean, it's kind of like the smell test. Again, not to talk too much about your improbable or not improbable joker, impractical jokers.
Yes.
But, like, I find myself laughing spontaneously at that. And it's that there's nothing more organic, and nothing that bonds me to a piece of media or entertainment or to a professor than that sort of, like, very natural, authentic, organic, you know, brilliance, really. And that, I mean, I'm not saying I'm brilliant, but what I'm trying to do is first take the basics and then figure out, well, how do we zest it up so people will never forget certain points about wine? So as just you said, you should have been a psychologist, Dane, because it's that transcendent, it's those extra little steps you go. And why do I bother, you might ask? I was just telling someone today, like, you know, people would show up, you know, if I didn't put so much into these things. But that, I think, is my crazy genetic makeup. I think the stars, the wires got crossed, and I just have to give it my all each time. It's just the way I'm built.
You don't want to say sugar coat, but maybe candy coat. Coat it in, like, maybe nougat or some kind of Rice Krispie chocolatey goodness or whatever, but kind of building in that kind of stuff. And I think once people, and maybe if you could fill us in, let the listeners know, of course, we're talking with wine expert, author, personality, Mark Oldman. What was the first thing that you did? Because that is a little bit of a risk. Because as you mentioned, maybe visually, you didn't have the tweed coat with, like, the leather patches, you know, or any of that stuff that started off. You already weren't walking like the duck that they figured they needed to see and learn from. At what point did you say, you know what, let's have a little fun with this? Was it, like, at what part did you build in? Because now, and you've sort of mentioned it, is there a little bit of pressure because now people expect that from you and you've got to do bigger and better. But as far as building in the entertainment, was it just the sense of humor? Is that how it started? What did you do?
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. First, I felt like just being myself and my intense desire for people to learn. And maybe I was quoting Curb Your Enthusiasm. A lot of it's stream of consciousness. I'll have, or, you know, speaking of Curb Your Enthusiasm, I've read about how that show works, and a lot of the great kind of like lightly scripted shows, there are certain points they need to hit, but they don't know how they're going to get from point A to point B to point C. So I became comfortable enough with my own knowledge, and the crowds at these wine festivals, I felt like they started coming back to see me year after year, and that gave me the confidence to really, what do the jazz musicians do, to kind of improvise a little bit. And then when that started working, I'm like, you know what, now I'm really going to give them a show. So, for example, a few years ago, I did wines that were criminally good. There's 300 people at Aspen. I ordered away, Dane. I ordered it. There are prison supply shops. Who knew this existed? So I ordered away for the black and white stripe. See, I thought it was all Guantanamo orange these days, but no, there are still, you know, like chain gang.
Yeah, the classics.
The classics. So I ordered that, and everything was like penitentiary themed, and these wines were some of the best in the world. And then one of my very active students, he reached out a week before the class, and he's like, is there any way I can help you out? And I'm like, well, actually, would you dress up as a police officer? And this was in Aspen at the Aspen Classic. And he went down to the police house, asked to borrow their uniform. Only in a small, like, relatively safe town like Aspen would the officers allow him to borrow one of their uniforms.
Oh, my God. And I could never see that happening anywhere.
Definitely not in New York. And so how we started the seminar, and this was a big risk. So 300 people pile into the tent, and there's a lot of anticipation, and I have him go up and make an announcement. I hate to tell you this, but Mark Oldman has been arrested, and he's currently in the Aspen jail right now, and he can't make it. And I had him leave the stage, and then people were like murmuring, and then he brought me back on the stage in handcuffs, and then we took the handcuffs off, and I started the show.
Oh man.
All sorts of things to make it memorable for people.
Well, and there's always some great themes too, and I think that's where a little bit of the idea happens. So you're not just necessarily picking out a region or picking out here, or even picking out things that I think would be in that team photo of things that people would want to learn about. You always build in a cool and fun angle because I think, you know, for some of those great people out there that have succeeded at menu writing, right? You read the menu and you automatically, it's just words, but it makes you want it.
Right.
It makes you be like, wow, that sounds really awesome. And that is a talent and a gift. And so to come up with some of these shows and even some of the topics for the wines, you know, you're going to get, you know, at that level. And for the listeners who haven't been out to the Classic at Aspen, it is sort of the pinnacle of the food and wine experience. And so anything that you get, whether you're learning knife skills from a Jacques Pepin or you're out there with, you know, stars of your favorite television shows, everything is a very elevated situation. You're learning great stuff. But when you have it written out where you're thinking of some of these themes that are just automatically attractions in and of themselves.
Exactly. For example, one theme I did, hard to say, easy to drink. And this was years ago, and we're not allowed to have audio visual because they need to build the tents and break them down, not the actual tents, but the stuff, the tables inside the tents. So you can't actually, and these are all temporary. So I brought a projector once, and I don't know if you remember, you're probably too young to remember, but on the old electric company, when Morgan, for the shadow of Morgan Freeman, they were showing, it was two shadows, and they showed you how to pronounce. It was like Gewurztraminer. And I actually had a graphic artist. I brought a projector and had a graphic artist make these visual pronunciations, but to famous wines I was presenting. And I think to this day, people remember now that It's Moët. It's not Moët, because Moët and Chandon, it's Dutch, or the name is originally Dutch in origin, or Perrier Jouet, not Jouet. So it's these little educational tricks that don't seem like education. Those are the things I respond to, and I remember.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I mean, that's, we all think of, at least many of us do, and I think they've come back with it now. Like Schoolhouse Rock, you're watching a cartoon, you're being entertained,
yes.
And in the end, you know what a conjunction is, right? So that's the way that it goes. We're going to take a break, and we come back. We have transcended to yet another level on the entertainment side, and Mark has taken the cutting-edge technology that exists and is available to all of us today, and not only created the virtual wine experiences that he does on a weekly basis, but something that is, I think, a battle for the ages, right? And we're going to talk about that when we come back. It's War of the Roses, Celebrity Deathmatch. We've got Mark Oldman on. Quick break. It's staying here, 720 WGN. I love the bumpers. Tom Hush is doing a great job. He is there in the booth, 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you, high atop Chicago. And on the line with us, we've got one of the leading voices in the world of wine. You can also, I think, describe him as unstoppable, irrepressible. It is the one and only Mark Oldman. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you.
Just
by the way, Dane,
oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No.
But I was just listening. This is so cool. This is late night, and you're a DJ. But are you familiar with the concept of the late night DJ voice?
I don't know. Would it be like lower and more breathy, you know,
exactly.
Soothing sounds? I mean, I you got to go to, maybe there's a separate kind of, I don't know. Well, Tom and I will work on it during the break. Maybe there's some sort of button he can push that'll make me sound.
Well, you sound pretty good. You're halfway there, but he's a former FBI negotiator. You could watch him on YouTube. I forgot his name.
Oh, okay.
But he talks about how the key to negotiating with people is the late night DJ voice. So I'm just excited that we're like in the late night DJ zone right now. Let's just throw that out there.
All right, we're gonna try one. Tom's got a thing like that. Are you ready? Go ahead, Tom.
Oh yeah, luscious hushes, baby.
There you go. That's what you do.
Awesome.
Yeah, when you've got your potential either terrorists or criminals, you got to talk them down, talk them out, whatever. You flatter them.
Yeah.
With the luscious baby. That's what you do.
Well,
so for all those people that think they're missing out on Mark Oldman because of the pandemic, they can't see him at any of their favorite events. They can always see him at markoldman.com. And then, of course, you're hearing him right now, 38 states and Canada. And then people are seeing you from all over the world on your kind of virtual seminars and experiences that you're doing. Talk a little bit about that before we get into this blockbuster thing that's happening coming up.
Yeah, so I've now, to relieve the pandemic blues, I'm doing these virtual events at markoldman.com. It's really easy to do. Some of them are free, and others are priced very conservatively because I know people are hurting right now in the pandemic, but I want to teach them about wine, and I cover all sorts of subjects. And in addition to the big crazy event I'm doing this week, I'm doing alternatives to champagne. The week after next week, I'm interviewing a guy who wrote the book on wine fraud, because counterfeit wines, it's becoming more and more of a thing. For example, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's Rosé, Miraval, gets counterfeited a lot. They've found a lot of these things. So we're going to do a week after next, inside the mind of a wine fraudster. And so all sorts of subjects. And people, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, people are finding Zoom, you know, pretty convenient, where from the comfort of your own living room, you can, you know, have a few glasses of wine. You can order the actual wines I'm presenting, or you can just bring along your own.
Wow. You see, I think it is one of those things that people are looking to, They become familiar, up to speed with the technology, just based on, you know, kind of tough love is that we have to. But also people are looking to kind of, you know, maybe learn that thing, maybe learn, you know, Tai Chi, or maybe get in shape or do the garden or whatever kind of thing they've always wanted to do or had a passion for. And I think being able to learn and get as good as you can on the wine side is what people are doing, because what you're seeing is that not only are people kind of checking in to learn one thing or another, but you, I mean, you really have to be sort of an educator here and have sort of a diverse and kind of fun kind of lineup, is that people are coming back, you know, week after week.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate in that the renewal rate has been 90%. So there, we've got a great core group of people coming back, but then new people are coming every event. Average events around 60 people, and people, I also welcome questions all the way through it. So people can type their questions, and I love that. I love, in fact, last week I just did an open Q&A, and it's really fun because, you know, you can ask the simplest, most basic wine question, or you can, you know, ask a black diamond question. Either way, people are going to learn. And one of my friends, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. So not that many of my friends are doing these virtual tastings because they're like, we get all this information at dinner anyway. But one of my friends, and I thought this was really sweet, he's like, you know, I don't buy the wines that you're presenting. I just like hearing you talk about it. And that was, to me, the highest compliment, especially for a friend to say, because you know how guys are with each other.
But that's high, no, but that is high praise, because you know, yeah, that ultimately they're getting the information, they're becoming a bigger, better expert, or at least enthusiast in the world of wine. And if it's passively, you know, just through sort of just the, you know, the company and hanging out and enjoying the conversation, having the ability to ask questions, then that's great, man. I'm kind of curious, because we're gonna have to take a break in maybe 2 minutes for Walter's perspective coming up, but if you could quick, I would think people would counterfeit, you know, some of those, you know, like a 100-year-old bottle of, you know, Chateau something, you know, something that would be like worth thousands of dollars. Like, what's the retail on Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's wine? I'm sure it's great, but doesn't it seem like that, Mark, doesn't that seem like it'd be, you know, like more trouble than it's worth to counterfeit?
It does. It does. And you are so right. Your instincts are perfect. 99% of the cases, it's these trophy bottles, but I think the counterfeiting started when there was a real lack of supply. Right when it came out, I think in China they found boxes and boxes of, and so it's only like a $25 wine now. So I don't know if it's still being counterfeited, but you're right. In most cases, it's the Mouton Rothschilds and the real wild trophy bottles, because, you know, It's a lot of work counterfeiting these things, apparently.
Well, now you mentioned Brad Pitt. He is going to be part of the celebrity death match, the War of the Rosés.
Oh, yes.
And so in a minute or so before we go to break, we can at least set the stage before we come back and flesh it all out. But you've got not only Brad Pitt and Angelina, but you've got John Bon Jovi, you know, Mary J. Blige, John Legend. I mean, you've got a really, like, talk about the kind of the combatants, if you will.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, with a new celebrity rosé coming to the market seeming like every week or so, I wanted to know which are good and which aren't. So this Tuesday night, it's free. People can sign up at markoldman.com. But yeah, Bon Jovi, Sarah Jessica Parker, John Legend, musician Post Malone, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, Francis Ford Coppola, and Mary J. Blige. And they're all going to compete, and people are going to vote. This is amazing. I just tested the Zoom function about an hour ago. I've never used the polling function before. But in real time,
awesome,
people are going to vote for their favorite, and we're going to have fun with it.
We're going to talk a little bit about it when we come back from this break. But I am curious if you have given thought. Now, there are so many celebrities getting into the wine game. I think it's a testament to the popularity, to the approachability, yeah, you know, because you've got a Francis Ford Coppola, you know, one of the, you know, legendary filmmakers, and you've got Post Malone. He's a legendary face tattoo guy. I mean, he's obviously successful in his career. But as far as like the type of, You know what I mean? I think the whole kind of wine and rosé thing, everybody feels like they've got a place, no pun intended, at the table with this. And so to have the polling function built into it, and I know we're going to talk about it in a minute when we come back, but were there any thoughts as far as like just the star power of some of these could skew the results one way or the other?
I'm thinking it could, and I thought about doing a blind tasting, which means in brown paper bags, but, you know, I think maybe the star power might be part of it, so let's just add that in. It'll make it that much more interesting, I think.
When we come back from this break, we are going to talk with Mark Oldman, markoldman.com. You can get all the information on all the different seminars and all the different topics and classes that he has, but coming up, we are going to flesh out the entire, we're going to break it down and do the odds for the War of the Rosés, the celebrity death match with all of those big celebrity participants, and I'm excited for that, so stay tuned for that right after this break. Right now, though, we're going to have Walter Jacobson's perspective. It is sponsored by HearingHealthCenter.com.
Hello, good morning, Mom and Pop. Are you still waiting for the check you were promised by the Federal Protection Program to help your small business survive the pandemic? Too bad for you. You'll have to wait some more because the checks are being sent to big businesses first, the ones with connections and clout. Billions to the airlines, $10 million each to 100 law firms, and millions more to campaign consulting firms and Washington lobbyists. The protection program is pouring money into the pockets of big business and political insiders. $350,000 to a hotel business partially owned by Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband. $350,000 to a maritime business owned by the family of Senator Mitch McConnell's wife. $350,000 to a real estate business owned by the family of President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. $600,000 to a big car dealership owned by a Texas congressman. $5 million to a bigger car dealership owned by a Nevada congresswoman's husband. Many billions are being delivered to big businesses, while small businesses are waiting for a few thousand dollars to rescue them. Same old story about government programs for everybody not being for everybody. So here's hoping, Mom and Pop, that when finally you receive what you've been promised to save your small business, it won't be too late to save it. I'm Walter Jacobson, and that's my perspective. For more, visit WGNradio.com or download the WGN Radio app.
720 WGN, it is Dane here with you, high atop Chicago Skyline Studio until 4 a.m. with you. And on the line with us now, we've said it before, one of the leading voices in the world of wine has now become really, I don't know, one of the Don King of the wine casks with his with the War of the Rosés. So, Mark Oldman, welcome back, number one. And then, so let's get into this. When it comes to celebrities, were these the only celebrities that you were aware of, or did you kind of handpick these for not only interest level or maybe quality of wine?
Yes, and yes. I source from wine.com, so basically I want one place nationally, so no matter what state you're in, where people can actually get these wines. If they, you don't have to, it's not mandatory to buy all seven wines, but if you want to participate, I wanted a place that A, it's in stock, and B, I wanted the price point to be no more than around $20. There are a few celebrities like, Kyle MacLachlan, he was on Sex and the City.
Oh, I know him.
He makes a really good guy, and his wines are beautifully made, but they start at around $30, and a lot of them are like $50 a shot. So I wanted to make these very affordable. So it's really about accessibility for people.
Now, here's the thing, too, is so some of these people, so John Bon Jovi, I know that he has a restaurant or at least a soup kitchen, right? He's got some of those things. And Francis Ford Coppola, as much as people appreciate his movies, he's a long time, he has his own vineyard, right? So you were a Post Malone, maybe just has a refrigerator, right? So were there some of these where the celebrities involved are either more involved? I know John Legend, has kind of worked on a collaboration. Maybe some of these people, they just stuck their names. Like, kind of run through the list and give your thoughts on each one of these.
Okay, I will. And, you know, I'm learning myself, so this is part of it. There are these kind of general questions I want to ask. Like, you know, in my world, there are a lot of writers who dismiss all celebrity wines as vanity projects, but I don't think that's the case. Maybe some are, but let's go through the list. Okay, so Bon Jovi from my beloved native New Jersey. This is so I think a lot will be determined by who their winemaking partner is. So he partnered with a very well-respected winemaker, Gerard Bertrand. And then I think a third partner is John's son. And, you know, the name is quite playful, Hampton Water, which was, people would refer to rosé as Hampton's Water, Hampton's with an S. So I think they very smartly took that nickname as the name for their rosé. It's funny, when I posted these and as people are signing up, I'm getting a lot of Bon Jovi fans come in and just say, well, yeah, it's going to be Bon Jovi. Like, he is a very vocal and loyal group on social media, I've got to say. But I expect good things because of his winemaking partner.
Nice. And of course, you'll see on the Zoom thing a bunch of people with lighters, right? Showing their appreciation in the typical concert way. So, okay, so who's next? We want to get to these guys.
Yeah. Okay, sure. Number two, Sarah Jessica Parker. I'm hoping her rosé is something that, you know, something more than a wine that will induce Sex in the City. Sorry, I had to. She's an actress of great integrity, and I know she's teamed with a gentleman named Rob Cameron and Tim Lightborn. These are serious people in wine, so I expect good things from her. John Legend. He is a foodie. His wife, Chrissy Teigen, is a foodie.
Yep.
He actually made some comments on my social media post. So I think he's in it to win it, too. Then we have Post Malone. I don't know what to think. But I'm keeping an open mind. Remember, people didn't think Paul Newman was a good race car driver, and he proved them wrong. So, you know, you never know. I'm keeping a very much an open mind. Then number five, you've got Miraval. I've had it before. This is the only one I've had before, but I haven't had the 2019 rosé. Brad Pitt and Angelina, of course, broke up, but they still are involved with their wine brands, so I expect it to be good. I've heard good things.
That's a testament. But just on that, that's a testament. You know, famously volatile couple, but that's the power of wine, that it can at least keep them together. Some people say they stay together for the kids. These guys together for the wine.
Exactly. It's you know, it would be a shame if they let that brand dissolve. So you got to at least keep that together. And I know it's gotten good reviews from trustworthy people. Then, as you mentioned, Francis Ford Coppola, very well respected in the wine world. This is the Sophia Rosé, named for his daughter, the director and the actress. I have a feeling it's going to be delicious. And then you have wine number seven. It's called Sun Goddess. It's from Italy, and it's Mary J. Blige's wine. And I'll tell you, this is from the Friuli region of northeastern Italy. When I first heard about this wine, and it's called Ramato, so it sounded like not maybe the most upscale wine like Ramato, but the more I read about it and the more I know about her partner, a gentleman named Marco, who's a real deal winemaker in Italy, I'm starting to think that these all might be good. Now, I don't have a horse in the game. No one's paying me to do this. If a wine turns out bad, we are going to say so. This is I'm under no contract or secret agreement to like a wine. So I'll give my own opinions. But what's so interesting about Zoom is I can't even vote. Like, I was testing it out. I'm like, okay, so can I vote along with everyone else? No. So we have almost 400 people signed up. I bet now.
Wow. Yeah, it's so cool.
Now that people, you know, your great audience knows about it, I bet we'll have many, many more. It's free for people. And I think the results, I mean, I'm hoping it tells us that celebrity wine should be taken more seriously, at least certain celebrity wines should be taken more seriously than the wine certain wine snobs do.
Well, or judged or taken seriously, or at least or judged on its own merit, right? Not necessarily on the label or the face or the name of the celebrity that may be attached to it. But you hit on it though too, is that you have to take you could take these people that may have, you know, success or notoriety in one walk of fame or another, but you look under the hood, so to speak, or into the horse's mouth, right? And if you've got quality people making it, well, then it's probably going to be good. Let's talk a little bit about rosé in general for those people. Of course, markoldman.com, you can get all the information as well. But for those people that may not be as familiar, are all rosés created, at least from the building blocks or the cornerstones, equal? It's pink, right? So you've got that. But other than right. that, what are some of the things that make up what is a rosé?
Well, great question. And I'm going to train everyone in the beginning how to evaluate what makes a good rosé, because not all rosés are created equal. And there used to be something called rosé resistance about 10 years ago. People associated rosé with kind of cheap and nasty and sweet and sugary drinks. By the way, I sometimes like those drinks
right,
too.
That
but
sounds good.
Not in wine, maybe, or if it's in wine cooler from. But there's, you know, the Europeans have been drinking this dry rosé, dry, refreshing style. I know there in Chicago, here in New York, you know, you really need good refreshment value. So I'm going to teach people to evaluate each of these rosés. First of all, the color. You know, they call rosé sunset in a glass. It can be salmon colored. It can be pale pink, it could be blood red. So is it an appealing color? Then we're going to smell it. We're going to taste it. Is it crisp and refreshing? Does it remind you of rose petals? Or is it just kind of like a muddy, kind of cheap and nasty smelling wine? And does it taste, is it refreshing when you taste it? Or is it kind of cloying and kind of clog up your pipes there a little bit. And I want people to come, and I want, you know, I can talk with my wine expert friends, and we can use words like dissident and buttery with a tinge of asperity and all these kind of meaningless words. But there's nothing like beginning wine people who will say, you know, got a little bitterness. I love hearing that because it's very authentic and you know, open.
Here's the thing, too, is if it authentically represents, you know, the celebrity that is attached to it, sort of like the dirty and gritty, I expect that from something that would be yes. offered up by Post Malone. In the last 30 seconds or so, markoldman.com is the place to go to get not only the education, a little bit on what makes a great rosé, but what is going to make the greatest rosé of these celebrities. So give that information out one more time.
You got it. So it's markoldman.com. You just go there. Click on virtual tastings and then click on the free celebrity rosé deathmatch, and we're going to have fun Tuesday night.
Oh, it's great. We'll have links up at WGNradio.com, Mark. I appreciate you doing it for the good of the wine world and, of course, our listeners as well. And thanks for jumping on the show tonight.
Thank you, Dane. It was really fun. And thank you, Tom, for the sound. It was great.
It's a thumbs up from Tom. Thanks, Mark. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, guys. Thank you. Bye.
All right. So we are going to take a break, and when we come back after the news, we're going to have a barbecue Hall of Famer, one of the greatest, I think bar none, the greatest barbecue cooker to ever come out of the Chicago area. Scotty Johnson is going to be joining us a little bit later on in the program. We're going to talk with Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian Donald Davidson. We are going to have Murr from Impractical Jokers. He's not just a funny guy. He's also one of those guys that is writing best-selling books. Tom, did you know that? No, Tom did not know that. But Tom's a reader, though, too. So this is going to be one of those things. We're going to get entertained. We're going to have a few laughs. We're going to learn some things. Stay tuned for the news. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, high atop Chicago in the Skyline Studio, and on the line with us now, always honored to have barbecue world champion, live fire guru, philanthropist with Cancer Such Chicago, and bar none, the greatest competition barbecue cooker ever to come out of the Chicagoland area, the one and only Scotty Johnson. Scotty, welcome to WGN.
Thanks for having me, Dane. Good to be here.
Well, it's always great to have you, sort of like our indigenous kind of like guru at the top of the mountain to be able to go to, not only for information, advice, you have your hand on the pulse of so many things in the barbecue world, but also a little perspective. And when it comes to Chicago, you know, we know the history. Everybody always gets a lot of attention, you know, Texas and Carolina and Kansas City. But Chicago is really, you know, how do you feel about that as far as Chicago's, is it an untold history? I actually emceed like the Great Chicago Barbecue Tour, and we went to like Honey One and Lem's and I-57. We went to some of those places and recognized it. But do you think nationally Chicago is yet to really feel the love it deserves?
You know, no, not at all. I mean, I think the true barbecue aficionados definitely know about Chicago, our style, you know, the aquarium cookers. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I absolutely traveled every single one of those restaurants that you mentioned and then some, just trying to figure out what was going on, how to cook barbecue, what I needed to do. And, you know, I grew up eating rib tips and hot links served on, you know, with some white bread. So I still love those. I could eat those, you know, every day right now. I absolutely love them. So, you know, and the sauce is definitely, you know, a little bit something different kind of thing, I would say, than what Kansas City or Texas, you know, with their thin watery, or out east in Carolina with their vinegar. But yeah, I definitely think Chicago has a style. I mean, I mean, I think they have it as much as, you know, a Nashville or something like that does. So, you know, is it in the top big ones with Carolinas and Memphis and Texas or Kansas City? No, but, you know, I think we're close. Second or fifth or whatever that would be. So
I love it. I are close. A close second or fifth. I chalk it up to that Chicago is just such a great city, whether it's the architecture, the sports, or the political corruption, or whatever it is, you know, that we make headlines for, is that we just have a lot more going on in barbecue. Although we do it at as high a level as anyone, we just have more things to be famous for than some of these other places.
Well, yeah, and let's face it, I mean, we were the hog capital of the world. So, you know, I mean, they're going to be cooking up and there's going to be scraps and stuff like that. And guess what those probably were rib tips and sausage. And, you know, we had a huge ethnic here with sausage. So it doesn't really surprise me that we, you know, went towards more of the rib tips or the, you know, in air quotes, the garbage meat. So
there's not, that'll maybe be an ancillary category down the road. We'll talk about that.
Hey, you know, I mean, let's face it, baby back ribs were once considered, you know, just a waste of the hog. No one knew what to do with those, you know. Now people are, you know, paying $8-$9 a pound for them. I don't know why, but it's, you know, chicken wings were another thing that were always just a throwaway of the chicken. And now, you know, they cost as much as buying, you know, chicken breasts. So
things fall kind of in and out of favor. Certainly there's been more either information, and some of it's been just, you know, word of mouth or the internet. It's been able to get kind of the word on the street out to a lot of different people. Some of it have been like really concerted and well-crafted marketing campaigns on the equipment side. Here, the hometown for Weber Kettle, you know, kind of the universal thing that everybody sort of has in the backyard, that maybe they feel like they're a barbecue expert or the king of the backyard or whatever. Everybody's got that kind of stuff. When it comes to some of the extra equipment that's out there, when you started and were winning world championships, you know, the information, it just, you had to kind of figure it out, like you said, do a little reconnaissance. You had to go talk to some of the other leaders in the sport, in the discipline, to get the information. And now I think if people have a decent internet connection, it's all there. You mentioned the aquarium smoker. Is that the next thing, as we get into, like, everybody knows what a Kamado is, everybody's got the stick burner, everybody knows pellet smokers? Do you think the aquarium smoker will ever catch on, Scotty?
God, I would hope so. I absolutely love them, but no, you know, they're pretty much here in Chicago. The old, you know, the old school places will have them in there. Every once in a while, you see them up for sale, and, you know, I would love to, you know, love to have one. I just can't can't justify having a big 5x5 smoker in the middle of my patio kind of thing. So it's bad enough my garage is covered with smokers that are all inside of there, you know, never mind now an aquarium one. So are they awesome? Yeah, I'd absolutely love one. But
our mutual guy, like Famous Dave, he's always been a big fan of the aquarium smoker, and I've seen some of the pictures he's got up in he has his own resort up in Hayward, and he's got an aquarium smoker up there.
Absolutely beautiful pit.
Yeah, it's a great thing. So what has been some of the things that has it been sort of the progression where maybe you saw it being used, or some of the origins of some of these different cookers being used and people winning and kind of cooking at a high level, and you said, oh yeah, once this catches on, people will have it? Or are there some things that you've been surprised about?
I guess you look at it now and it is, people are sort of surprised with the popularity of pellet cookers and that sort of thing. I was way ahead of the game. I got my, you know, hybrid pellet cooker. I think it was either 2000 or 1999 that Fast Eddie made it out of Kansas City. And, you know, and it was strictly for competition. He used the guts of a Traeger smoker, so like the box that would shoot the pellets down into the fire pot, and then the actual guts, you know, with the thermostat on it. And then he just built this big thing that sort of looked like a fridge around it and made it really insulated. And, you know, it became one of the better competition cookers, which is actually what I used when I won the world championship. So they've sort of made this cycle again, you know, where people were sort of afraid. And I think it was just more because everyone thought they were electric cookers where, you know, the only electricity was running the augers, which is no different than a rotisserie on a pit, and you use electricity for that. So they don't provide heat. So I think that would probably, you know, be my surprise one. Right now, the real popularity is, you know, like the Texas idea with the offset cookers, and people are using you know, wooden sticks and stuff like that. The newest thing, though, are the drums, where people are using, you know, all garbage can kind of things, 55 gallon drums that they've made into this, the whole, you know, cooking hot and fast kind of thing, where you're cooking basically right over the coals, then you're dripping right onto the coals and getting extra flavor that way. So yeah, they've definitely, but then like you said, Weber, I learned how to cook barbecue on a Weber kettle in the backyard and progressed from there. You know, Weber still makes a Weber Smoky Mountain that, to be honest with you, I don't know if there's a better, for the money, a better smoker out there for the backyard. Someone wanting to start off, you know, probably $400, you can get a, like I said, one of the best cookers out there that'll, you know, hold temperatures. You know, the downfalls are if it's really windy or if it's really cold out, but you know, if you're cooking in the summertime, spring or fall or something like that, they, or you put a wind block up and you won't get any more consistency than using a, you know, good old Weber right out of here in Chicagoland. So
it's the kind of thing that you're kind of surprised is that people are able to achieve championship level results off of just a variety of different things. So a lot of it comes into, certainly you need the equipment, some equipment, right? But you can get, you know, just a real variety of success based on whether it's the technique or the patience or the recipes or some of the things. Do you feel now that everything's sort of been made, and now with the internet, even like the smallest businessman, but has maybe an artisan or, you know, metal worker or whatever, you're seeing a lot of that stuff pop up and get some kind of popularity, that back when you were doing it, is that people, there was just maybe more of an innovative spirit to how it was done, where people were either
Absolutely. Let's face it, that's how, you know, like the garbage can cookers came about, was because people could have, you know, and they could make that sort of thing, you know, in their backyard. I mean, man, when I first started, there was nothing out there. I mean, it was like David Close down in Houston made an offset pit. You know, some guys came along after that. Oklahoma Joe had one as well back then. Weber Smoky Mountain was it. You know, they Brinkman had one that was just terrible. But the Weber Smoky Mountain was a pretty good one. And you know, there just wasn't a lot out there. And let's face it, there, when I started back in the day, the internet was slowly but surely coming around. And that's how I got found competition barbecue. And that was by going on there. I got this smoker from Home Depot, and I thought I was just the, you know, the guru of barbecue. And then little did I know, you know, I tried to figure out how to cook a turkey for Thanksgiving, and I found a barbecue forum, and as they say, the rest is history. Wow. I found out there was competition barbecue, and all because I wanted to cook a turkey, I found this forum and asked some guys some stuff, and next thing you know, I'm cooking competition. So
it's the kind of thing, and to let the listeners know, we're talking with Scotty Johnson, world champion, the greatest competition cooker to come out of Chicago. As many great food personalities as we have when it comes to competition barbecue, nobody has done more than Scotty Johnson, and an advocate for it too, you know, an ambassador for all of those kind of things, seen and done so much. When you mention that though, like, you kind of just like, I don't want to, you know, just kind of stumbling into the fact that competition barbecue exists. Are you surprised that even now, with as popular, and I got to say, it's got to be the most universal cooking discipline out there. You know, there are people that like certain types of cooking and everybody does a certain type of this or that. But as far as like the thing that most people have some, I think, at least familiarity with, is like, you know, cooking on a grill in the backyard is something everybody sort of has. Are you surprised that even with everything we have, with some television shows out there and with the internet, that as many people just aren't even aware that there is the whole competition world?
You know, it does. I mean, there's a ton. It's either people get it or they don't. It almost seems like, you know, I mean, it's surprising how many people, you know, ask me, like, if I do the same kind of, you know, barbecuing is some of those barbecue shows. And I'm like, well, you know, yes and no. You know, I mean, it's like all those people are friends of mine and, you know, they're competition cookers, but we don't really sit there in front of judges and cook and they ask us questions while we're cooking kind of thing. You know, we're behind where they don't see us and there's walls so the judges don't see us. So, but there's stuff out there. I mean, people will find it. You get some people that are just absolutely barbecue aficionados that, you know, they will find competition barbecue because they're just into it. But, you know, nowadays with the Google and you type in barbecue, it's amazing, you know, what you can find and if, how much searching you do for it. So, but I honestly absolutely love it that people are stumbling into the competition world, you know, even if they give it for a year or two and try their hand at it because, you know, like you said, everyone feels they can do it.
Just as you were able, like maybe some of the roadblocks to your access were just whether it was lack of the internet or information or, you know, just some of the ways that people are finding it now. One of the, I think, roadblocks, and I think we've done a little bit to kind of talk about, hey, you can cook great food. You don't have to spend a ton of money. But as you get to when, you know, people see if they do a little investigation on the competition side and they see what some of these top teams are using, it's kind of a prohibitive entry point, right? If you look at some of the things, you think, okay, if I want to cook great, if I want to be the greatest of all time, I got to get what Darren Worth has. And you look at it and it's like, geez, you really got to make a commitment.
Well, I mean, you do, but then again, there's guys that are out there that are winning. You know, I've won contests where I traveled in and, you know, threw everything in my SUV and traveled in and smoker either towed it or, you know, had just had a 10x10 easy up a table, you know, some tubs to wash dishes, you know, a Cambro and a cooler and go in and win. And, you know, and then there's guys with $100,000 RVs or, you know, trailers or whatever that pull in and, you know, their smokers are mounted in the back and they don't have to unpack anything, you know, that win as well. But, you know, you'll notice though, that the teams that tend to win are the teams that are willing to put the money and the time into it. And to do that, you know, you got to have some comforts. I mean, I used to cruise around in a Class C RV, you know, I'm pulling my smoker behind me and in the back of the RV, it was a garage style RV, they call them. So I had a 10 foot area in back there where I would store stuff and I would convert it into a total kitchen for competition. So, you know, I understand that, but it's like, I've also gone in though, where someone can literally get into it at a cheap end and just have a tent and, you know, their smoker and a table and coolers and they can compete with the big boys and, you know, and still win. I mean, I find nothing better than going to a contest and like literally, you know, a team that first time they've ever cooked, and they come in and they get a top 10 call.
That's great.
And they get a ribbon, and you know, and it's the start of their downfall of spending $100,000 because of a $5 ribbon. So, oh, you know, once you're hooked on it bad, you know. It's like, well, I've just got a, you know, eighth place ribbon. Look at how pretty it is. I can cook with anyone. And next thing you know, you're becoming me kind of thing, and you know, you cook in 43 different states, and you know, cook 200 contests, and yeah, make it a full-time job and still work and do things. So
as a public service, yeah, I guess you're right, Scotty, we should probably throw out that disclaimer, you know, that is a warning, right? Is that this could be, and really is, it's kind of addictive. You know, not only is the food great, but here the camaraderie is great too. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk some of the things that make it a little bit different from what you may see in your backyard, the equipment. We talked a little bit about that, but also the food. It's a little bit, or maybe a lot different than the kind of stuff you would normally bake, the kind of stuff that is winning competition. We'll talk about that as well as the barbecue community. We got Scotty Johnson on with us. Dane here on 720 WGN. WGN is Dane here with you, high atop Chicago Skyline Studio, on the line, continuing our conversation with barbecue world champion, Chicago's very own Scotty Johnson. And Scotty, you've always kind of offered up that inspirational olive branch to maybe the new cooker, saying, hey, you don't have to have the most expensive rig. You don't need a Jambo. You can get in there and you can compete. And you've seen those things happen with equipment than you could get, you know, at your local hardware store and whatever. And you can progress from there if you feel like you want to take it more seriously, or maybe, you know, the spirit moves you and you become addicted to it. But on the food side, you know, with people in their backyard, oh my gosh, this is the greatest, you know, chicken I've ever tasted. You should join or kind of enter in competitions. There's a different thing. If you can explain a little bit about the differences as far as the type of food that is entered in competition as opposed to just your average backyard party.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first number one thing is when you're cooking competition barbecue is we're looking to try and get the best meat we possibly can. You know, whether that's getting chicken from Jewel or getting it from Whole Foods, or, you know, there's teams that have chicken that is overnighted delivered to them for competition. So the quality of meats is a number one, the difference between what people are cooking, you know, in the backyard and what we're cooking on competition side. You know, like we're using Wagyu briskets, which are these cross between a Japanese cow and then a certified Angus beef, to make this Wagyu. So it's this beautifully marbled, very expensive, you know, a couple $100 for a brisket, which is another one of those deals. You spend $200 to win $225. But
Scotty, you've seen too, where, and I've seen some of the stuff online, and yes, you got to have, I think, a certain level of quality of meat, but some of the people that overpay for the Wagyu, it's not like an automatic guarantee you're going to win.
Absolutely not. I mean, I guarantee you, just because you spend that kind of money, you can finish first or you can finish 40th in a contest. So nothing guarantees because you've spent the most money you're going to win. That's why we have they call it double blind judging in the Kansas City Barbecue Society, where they don't know whose box they're judging, kind of thing. You know, they can take guesses and everything else, but I guarantee you they don't know. The judges don't have a clue of who they're judging. So that's the whole point, is to try and equal the field out. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, that you can win, you know, back when I first started, certified Angus beef was, you know, a very high end of it. And then all of a sudden it switched over a little bit to prime beef. And then it made a quick jump from prime right into the Wagyu. And, you know, they're just different animals. They're better cuts of meat. Yep. Same with the ribs. You know, we were very particular about it. I'd go to a certain store to get my ribs. I'd go to another store to get my chicken. I would go to a third store to get my pork. you know, and then a fourth place to get my briskets if I didn't get them overnighted into me. So, you know, it was definitely, like I said, it's a lot of work when you're doing it full time, as I call it, basically every kind of weekend or every other weekend. It was a full time job. So that's definitely the number one aspect. The other thing is, you know, definitely the quality of the equipment. Doesn't mean that you can't win on, you know, as I said previously, you can definitely win on cheaper smokers. I mean, that's not holding anyone back. Good barbecue is good barbecue. It doesn't matter what it's cooked on. It's what it tastes like to those judges. So, you know, yes, you can go anywhere from, you know, cooking on Weber grills or, you know, the lower end smokers for, you know, $300-$400, you know, up to cooking on a Jambo style cooker, you know, that can, you know, cost $18,000-$19,000 for one of those. So there's everything in between there, though. So it doesn't necessarily, because you're spending more, you're going to win more. I mean, usually people that are spending more are, you know, better quality teams, and they're winning to begin with. So this is just them keeping them feel that it's going to give them an edge by spending more money on a better cooker style or that sort of thing. So you can definitely win by using, you know, quote backyard.
As a guy that's familiar with the competition world today and see kind of what it is and what sort of is like the standard of the meats that are cooked or the standard of some of the acceptable equipment that has some successes, and you and I are both music fans. And so what were some of those moments? You mentioned getting in on the pellet cooker thing, which is now pretty universal, right? And you know where I think I saw one at Jewel for sale, which is like, I mean, gosh, it's jumped the shark. So what were some of those moments from, and the music kind of connection is, you know, we all remember the first time we heard Metallica, it was like something totally different, or Eruption, you know, Eddie Van Halen's like Eruption guitar solo, it was like, what is this? What were some of those moments in the barbecue world, whether it was like someone brought in a different meat that had never been used before, or someone tried, you know, brought in a different piece of equipment that really just kind of caught on because it changed the game?
You know, honestly, I would say the number one thing is technology. I mean, when I was first going, you know, and this is only like 20 years ago or so, we didn't have, you know, everything from a thermopen, which is a, you know, an instant read thermometer where we could stick it in the meat and literally get a read back, you know, within a second of what the temperature is of the meats. When I first started, you'd stick it in, close the door, you know, because it would take 10 or 30 seconds to actually get up to finally up the temperature. What? And you'd walk away, you'd forget it, and the thing would be melted the next time you came back and looked at it. So, you know, that was number one, was just get that kind of technology. The internet is just huge because, I mean, there just wasn't that kind of information on like how to cook a competition pork butt when I was starting off. Yeah, the internet was around, you know, and remember, this is only 20 years ago,
right?
But now it's just flooded with everything. Guys are doing YouTube videos and, you know, competition cooks are putting their stuff out there, with me from, you know, a contest that I'd go to where guys were just shadowing me and watching me doing turn-ins and that sort of thing. You know, so there's tons of videos out there. The quality of meats has just gone up. You know, that's another thing that has just amazed me from when I started to what it is now. I mean, the quality of the meats is just amazing. And, you know, now it's just, and the other thing is just what guys are using to make it comfortable for them to be able to cook. And, you know, and make it comfortable for them. When I, you know, when I was going, if someone had like a, you know, basically a cargo trailer, they were pretty fancy back in the day. You know, now everyone pulling in with RVs or trucks with big, huge trailers and, you know, specific, they call them porch model trailers where the cooker is mounted on the back of them. You know, that's just standard fare now with the guys pulling in. So, you know, it's definitely just been advancement. I think it's just been guys are molding other sports into the sport of competition barbecue and making it, you know, more comfortable and that sort of thing. So,
and I think just the information too, like, you know, like you said, is that people know what's out there, you know, where they have access to, whether it's those tips or the cooking techniques or equipment or meats or any of those kind of things. And some of the times I always use that example, you know, sort of that epiphanal moment where you just didn't know that it could be better or could be different. When we would go to Ponderosa, you know, it was a big Friday night or something, we're going to be living, right? So we're going to Ponderosa to have steak, and then and you think that that's great because you just don't know any better. And then you have your first, you know, steak from a butcher shop and you're like, I didn't know it could be like this. And so now everybody has sort of the aspirational, whether it's the equipment or the meat or even the instruction. And so, but here's the thing, Chris Lilly mentioned it. You've mentioned it before too. You can have all the information in the world. It's execution. And so you still have to be able to do it. Like, what does it take? Are there any Michael Jordans out there that just have this natural talent for it? Or if you're already a chef, are you geared to it? Or is barbecue a different discipline? And is it just about putting in the time?
You know, I mean, I'm old school in that regard where it's just like the more you practice, the better you become. You know, I mean, it's like my kids won't eat chicken because I would be cooking it, you know, every night for a month, you know, kind of thing. And you do that so that you can literally do it in your sleep kind of thing. And there's no thought to it at all. So I knew exactly what I was doing to make the best chicken that I could possibly, what I thought was going to win. You know, but ultimately though, Dane, it comes down to if you hit the right table with the right judges, you know, I mean, you got to put out food on a tee so the judges can have the best swing at it as they could. You throw them a curveball with spicy or salty or, you know, whatever different kind of thing. Some guys are going to like it. Others aren't. So you can get every single kind of instruction in the book. I'll put them out there. You know, people want to know them. I'll let them know. I'll post it on Facebook. I'll post it in groups, wherever. Doesn't mean you're going to be able to cook it though. So, you know, like I said, you can put it out there for guys, whether or not they want to practice it and become, you know, it isn't something that's just handed to you. It definitely takes a lot of practice and skill. And while some might come along and be, you know, instant hits, it doesn't happen too often. You know, guys are either going to cooking classes or they cooked on a team or they, you know, as we say, they dishwashed for a team for a while where they're just hanging out and seeing how to cook and learning how to cook and, you know, learning how to become a champion, as I always used to say. But not too often guys are just coming out without any knowledge and winning on the circuit just because of taste and tenderness is a little bit different than what you're serving in a restaurant.
The taste and some of those other things that are happening, this is another, I think, element that's gotten a little more, maybe a lot more attention or familiarity, and you're seeing a lot more out there. I remember as a kid growing up, we just had the magic seasoning with like Paul Prudhomme stuck to the side of it. That was it, or maybe some things from McCormick. And now, you know, not only do you have, you know, some of the basic stuffs that have been around years are endorsed by, you know, some great personalities. Now you've just got things, you know, popping up all over the place. And I think to a variety of success. What are your thoughts on that? Or is there some base that you could share with the listeners, some like a basic like go-to of like this? And you could say Texas salt and pepper, I mean, I guess, but are there things like beyond that are still kind of universal and people should look at?
You know, there's so many. I personally right now, I love to have the plain simple salt, pepper, and a little garlic powder in there, or garlic, granulated garlic in cooking my barbecues now. You know, maybe throw a little bit of cayenne if I'm looking for some heat. But, you know, there's so many rubs out there, and they have them in the stores. And, you know, the way I always looked at it was because when I first started, I got books and I had books on how to make rubs and what you're looking for. And I'd have absolutely crazy ones, you know, with rosemary and just absolutely loved it. But in competition world, that doesn't work. You know, you need to have the basics of salt, pepper, sugar, cayenne, paprika, you know, onion, garlic and that sort of thing. But when you start going crazy, you know, in the, at least the competition world crazy, like with rosemary or, you know, garlic, lemon, chicken, while it's great to eat off the grill at home and in the backyard, that's going to absolutely sink like a lead ship, in the competition world. But I mean, even now they have, you know, stores, their store out here in Downers Grove that they have a whole barbecue section, you know, and they probably have 50 different rubs and sauces and cooking stuff. And, you know, and there's another store up in Wilmette, same deal, you know, where they're carrying all these competition sauces and rubs and that. These guys make these because they're good. I mean, and that's the way I look at it.
Yeah.
If I want to have a good sauce, I can sit there all day long and probably make a good sauce and it'll take me 3 hours. Or I can run up to Jewel or one of these specialty barbecue stores and buy a bottle of sauce for, you know, $3, $4, or $5 kind of thing. And these guys have perfected it where it's a good bottle of sauce. You know, and I always used to use sponsored rubs and sauces. I didn't really make anything. I would tweak my rubs and my sauces, you know, a little bit what I thought the judges were going to like. You know, but do I have books? Yeah, I've probably got 20 books down, you know, in my collection for barbecue books where it's all about making sauces and rubs. And, you know, I looked at them, I read them just to get ideas of how to do things. It's a lot of work I'm doing all that. And I'm all about making barbecue easy now. So I use already pre-made commercial rubs and sauces, and there's some good stuff out there.
Yeah, it's kind of like, if it's not broke, don't fix it. You know, we all, you know, you need a light bulb. Could you probably look online how to make your own light bulb? Maybe, I guess. It's easy just to go buy one that works and works great because you already have that figured out. To let the listeners know, we're talking with barbecue legend Scotty Johnson. He is on with us. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to finish up with really what is the most, I think, important and special ingredient in the barbecue world, which is the people, which is the community and the people that make it not only go, but also kind of share all of that great food and that great family. So keep it here. It's staying on 720 WGN. WGN is Dane here with you, high atop Chicago Skyline Studio, and on the line with us, joining us again is barbecue legend, guru, world champion, Chicago's very own Scotty Johnson. And Scotty, welcome back.
Once again, thank you.
Yeah, when we went to break, we kind of teased it out there that there was one ingredient that that we haven't necessarily talked about that is maybe the most important ingredient to keeping all of this kind of barbecue explosion, I think, in popularity together. And what keeps all those people kind of coming back? Because you've talked about it. It's hard. It's hard to do it well. It's expensive. It's addictive. This is not an easy thing to get in on. And but the barbecue community, and as a guy who's covered, you know, the food world in and around of it in the barbecue community, there is nothing. There is no other discipline within the culinary world that has the people that make it go, that run it, that lead it, that are more, I think, cohesive, you know, that are more together, more communal than the barbecue community. If there's a disaster, they're the ones mobilizing and getting out. And I think part of it is maybe the mobility of the food, but it's also, I think, the DNA and the mindset of the people in it. So Scotty, talk a little bit about that. Like, you're a big part of and a member of that community. And that was probably, even from Chicago, that maybe doesn't get as much attention for the barbecue world, is one of the things that kept you, you know, in and around it, right? It was the friends, family, the people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's face it. That's one of the reasons why. I mean, we went out and cooked 43 different states, and my girls had, you know, they grew up out on the barbecue circuit. They had friends from, you know, Arizona to New England to Florida to, you know, the South, where they were looking forward to going there because they had friends, you know, from seeing friends at other contests. I mean, there's a circuit where guys are going to be going from contest to contest. And generally, I would try and stay close to home as much as possible. But, you know, you'd also chase contests because of friends. You'd chase contests because of locations. You'd chase contests because they were, you know, big money and you're going to go and try and hit some big money and get lucky. So yeah, but the friends though, I mean, there's, you know, I still have friends that I met online 20 years ago that I would consider, you know, outstanding friends. We became even better friends going out on the circuit, and the camaraderie that you get. And, you know, I mean, it's one of those deals where you want to beat everyone's ass, you know, the next day when it comes to judging. But I guarantee you, on a Friday night, if you forgot something at home, you forgot a rub, a sauce, or, you know, aluminum foil or gloves or whatever it was that you forgot, I guarantee you within 5 minutes you could have whatever you're looking for from the team stepping up and the teams, you know, giving whatever they had to be able to help you out. So that's just how it was. I mean, the whole community of the barbecue competition world is everyone from, you know, doctors, attorneys, down to, you know, garbage men to, you know, I mean, it's just every job in between, from blue collar to white collar to, you know, people that have their own businesses to, It's just, I've seen everything out there, and the people that, you know, that's what makes it so special, is because once you put on, you know, that apron on a Friday and a Saturday, everyone's equal. There's no one that's better. It doesn't matter that, you know, your equipment, doesn't matter what your job, your title, none of that. All that matters is come Saturday and what you're turning in. So that's what makes it so special, is that there's just no, you know, certain type that's going to do better than others. We're all a big community out there.
And, I can't.
You know, the Friday night fun is probably the best thing, where everyone gets together and, you know, everyone lets their hair down and have fun and tell stories and, you know, eat food and drink drinks and, you know, just have fun kind of thing.
Yeah. So. Well, now, Scotty, you hit on it, and I had not necessarily thought about it that way, but I cannot think of another almost anything that really pulls in people from all walks of everywhere. You hit on it, whether it's executives or professionals, and whether it's just, you know, small town people or entire families or whatever draws them in, you know, that I think common bond and passion just like supersedes all of it. And sometimes you don't even know who these people are in their it's not like they're like, yeah, I'm a doctor and I'm doing this. Like, it's like their barbecue personality and their persona like takes precedence during those weekends. You don't even know who these people are sometimes.
No, you know, and honestly, it doesn't really matter. I mean, there's guys that, you know, I knew for 5 years and I didn't know what they did. Right. You know, they showed up in their overalls and, you know, and their ripped up t-shirts and their, you know, thongs on, and they were ready to you know, cook barbecue and find out that they were, you know, judges. And, you know, and they're, you know, Monday through Thursday, when they weren't in court, they were in court and they were being a judge kind of thing, you know, and it was just like, it didn't really matter, to be honest with you. I mean, everyone was equal once you get behind and start cooking. So that's the fun part about it, though, you know, and like I said, we enjoyed it just because we went to so many different regions and, you know, got to know so many different people. And I mean, we got to see America and got to see what all Americana was all about. So that was fun.
And as many differences as we all have, whether it's like, you know, from different areas or different backgrounds or politically or whatever, you know, to see people come together over barbecue is something that is really kind of transcendent and special. One of the last things is, like, what do you think it is? Is it, you know, people sometimes say that it's, you know, primordial, it's like, you know, caveman and fire stuff, and that's what draws people and keeps people in, is that we're just sort of hardwired as a species, right? Not necessarily with any background, to love barbecue and love live fire cooking, or is it something else? What do you think?
You know, I think it might be a little bit of everything, Dane. I mean, let's face it, a lot of it has to do with competition. You know, the whole camaraderie of the backyard barbecue, you know, it's always been this family thing of people getting together, you know, whether or not you're in the South or the, you know, East or Texas or wherever. You know, barbecue here might have been people pulling out the Weber and grilling hamburgers and hot dogs, whereas barbecue in other areas was them legitimately making slow smoke barbecue. But it always brought people together, brought family, friends, parties, you know, and so that's the fun part about it, is that sort of thing. You know, people, I have so many friends that have turned the competition barbecue into the next step, and they're opening up restaurants and, you know, food trucks and catering businesses and that. So that, you know, that's another thing. I did the opposite. I tried to raise money, you know, for cancer research for a few years there. So I had my goal as well, but everyone has their own reasons. But I mean, ultimately, I think what keeps it all together, though, is the friendship, the fun. You know, like I said, everyone wants to beat everyone's ass come Saturday, but the whole barbecue community of people having fun and friendships, you know, let's face it, majority of the time, you're not hearing politics, you're not hearing what's going on with the world. You know, nowadays it's a little bit more with, you know, people being more laid back and distanced and stuff like that because of this virus going around. But you just didn't hear all that. You know, people were friends. It didn't matter. You know, I mean, there'd always be back and forth, you know, like between college teams or, you know, the Packers and the Bears and that sort of thing.
Yes.
I love them. But, you know, so you'd have that little banter back and forth, but you didn't have that whole thing, you know, where people are disagreeing about politics or, you know, whatever the hot topic of the day was, because guys were there to have fun and not worry about that, not have a care in the world and, you know, just get to know people and have fun. So.
As we get to like the, you know, the one thing everybody can agree on, I think, is that barbecue is as big and as, no pun intended, hot as it has ever been. As more people either get up to speed, they know what's possible, what kind of cool things they can do or cook in the backyard. I think the pandemic may have accelerated that. You know, people have more time in, they can't go to restaurants. You know, they've got to kind of figure it out. And what better way to figure out something great than to do some barbecue in the backyard? And so I think that's one of the great things. But as a guy who's been there, seen it all, done so much at the highest level for the best reasons, and you see kind of what barbecue is today, whether it's the competition side or just the prospects of just kind of mass awareness of all the great things that you've been doing this whole time, what do you see as like the future for barbecue?
You know, I really hope it does. I mean, I'm not saying competition. I mean, obviously I went for the competition angle just because I was, you know, competitive in nature. But I really hope it does, where guys, you know, are in their backyard and they enjoy it. And, you know, you learn the cooking of low and slow, and, you know, with live fire cooking. It's the greatest thing in the world. You know, like I said, you can invite friends over, you know, it can have fun. I mean, it can lead to competition barbecue, because let's face it, everyone is the best barbecue cook in your block when no one else makes it. So, you know, who's gonna pass up and say, no, your barbecue's terrible, when people are giving you a slab of ribs? So, and, you know, and it can just progress from there, that if all of a sudden someone wants to take the next step and do like a backyard cooking, or if they want to step up and compete in the, you know, the big contest, they can. So to me, that's awesome. You know, I'd love to see more barbecue restaurants out there. You know, I love barbecue. You know, the fact that guys are making it. So yeah, you know, I just hope it keeps growing. It's fun. Makes me smile, you know, seeing that, you know, where it's come, from where I started to what it is now. And, you know, the barbecue restaurants that are opening, and, you know, restaurants here cooking legit, you know, barbecue that's really good. So I hope it keeps growing. It's great seeing, you know, stores like Ace Hardware carrying, you know, Big Green Eggs and Traeger grills and Weber grills and that sort of thing. And, you know, Weber making pellet grills. It's just all excitement. I hope it keeps growing and keeps going from there. You know, like I said, back in the day, you didn't go into an Ace Hardware and have that many different styles of smokers that you could buy there, you know. And now it's happening. So I hope it just keeps growing.
It's a testament. I mean, it's a testament to all that stuff, all that work, all that success, all that great work on the ambassador side, getting the word out, all the, just all kind of the progression of things that you knew from the get go and were, and I don't want to say addicted to, but you were like attracted to initially and immediately. And obviously that's a universal language and a lot of people are speaking it now. So Scotty, as we let you go, is there, you know, we'll have links up at WGNradio.com where people, cause that's one of the things that you're great with, is you're just open. You mentioned as far as sharing some of the things that you do and techniques, and certainly advice and inspiration and encouragement, right, for people that want to get into it. But is there any other, you know, either website or things you want to leave us with for people to get more information?
No, there's Facebook pages, you know, with like Chicagoland Barbecue and that sort of thing. It's fun to see, you know, you get everyone from just backyard guys that absolutely love it there to competition guys that hang out on there in Facebook. You know, tons of different barbecue groups out there. You know, the Chicago group, they do some fun bus trips where they'll hop around and go to like six different restaurants, you know, on a Saturday afternoon kind of thing. You know, get out there and try it. It's fun. It's a good community. And it doesn't necessarily just need to be the competition community. I mean, there's a bunch of good guys out there in the barbecue world. You know, enjoy it. Have fun. You know, you can eat your mistakes. That's the best part about it. And, you know, and go from there. So, you know, I've made some great brisket chili out of some really bad brisket I made. So, you know, I mean, it's fun. Try it. Have fun. You know, and go from there. You never know what's going to happen. Go out and see a contest firsthand live and, you know, see if it's, something that you might want to do if you're a competitive guy and in the competitive cooking. So
check it out
and ask questions, and don't be afraid to ask questions. You know, everyone always thought that the top teams never liked to answer questions or they're unapproachable. And you know what? I used to love people coming and talk to me. I'll give you every recipe I got. Doesn't mean you can cook it, but I'll give you everything I got. Or the other thing is, you got to figure out if I'm lying to you. It's the other one. But, you know, most of the time, you know, they'll give you 3/4 of what the real recipe is. So yeah, 3/4 of nothing is pretty good. So
yeah, 3/4 of the way there is great. A little mystery built in. You got some to do's on the work side. So Scotty, thanks again so much for everything that you do for the community, for, you know, on the ambassador side, carrying that torch for great barbecue, not only great barbecue, but also Chicago barbecue. Absolutely. As well. And thanks for jumping on WGN tonight.
Thanks, Dane. Appreciate having me.
WGN, Dan here with you until 4 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio tonight, and of course he'll be back with us next week, and excited to have a lot of really cool stuff going on as people try to decide what they can do with the rest of their summer. And one of the ways that people are getting out and about is enjoying a road trip, and there is no better place to go, well, depending on your options, I guess, right, than the well-recognized entertainment capital of Illinois, Peoria, Illinois. He has gone there. He is calling from there. It is the one and only Blockbuster, Blake Stubbs. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Dane, how are you doing? It's been a while. It's been a minute, I guess you could say.
It's hard because, you know, I think the ability to track time is like pandemic time. It's one of the things that's been sort of affected, right? Because it's hard to even, I don't want to say it's hard to remember exactly what day of the week, but things are just a little bit kind of bizarro world these days.
I have to agree, namely because I did about 5 weeks of quarantine there for a while, like everybody else. And I know some people out there are still in quarantine, so they're really feeling the impact of this. Well, what time is it? What does it matter? You know, like, that's kind of how it is. Like, as long as they get done what they need to get done, sleep whenever you see fit. But I managed to be back on a bit of a hard routine. You know, I'm back to my day job. Advertising is kicked back up. And as you know, Dane, I make commercials for a living.
Yes, you do.
So that's one of those things that, you know, once that got going again, you know, you ease back into it. But even as you're easing back into it, you're still like, your sense of when you go to sleep and when you get up and when you do things. And I got to be honest with you, I got pretty bad there for a while. I was watching way too many movies and catching up on TV shows during that 5 week stint. And while I feel like I'm caught up on everything I've, you know, wanted to watch for a long time, days kept running together and you just kind of lose complete and utter track. And now I feel like I'm back to a version of normal, I think is what it is. I think I'm back to a version of normal, not, you know, the full on normal, which I think we're all kind of like, is that ever going to happen again? But a little bit of an adjustment, to say the least.
Well, now, full on normal, was that the working title for Full Metal Jacket before they decided to kind of settle on on sort of the war theme? When it comes to we're going to talk a little bit about road trip in this first segment, because it is the kind of thing that not everybody has done. You did it in the name of movies and entertainment, in the name of all the things that you were doing from Peoria all the way to Hollywood. And so you've done that certain road trip thing, I think, in the spirit of, let's say, Easy Rider or maybe Thelma and Louise, right? Those road trip kind of situations. So what is it like for people that are now, because maybe the typical vacation or the thing they would normally do isn't available, and so maybe getting in a car out there in nature, you know, with the wind in your hair or however it works, people are thinking road trip. What was it like to go from, let's say, middle America all the way out to the West Coast?
Well, for me, there was a big shock because I knew the end destination was going to be a desert. That's where I was going to end up really living, was in the Palm Springs area. Now, I spent a lot of time in L.A. I did work in L.A., so of course I got to have my movie fantasies kind of come to life when you're in, you know, the greater Hollywood, Los Angeles area. You get to see it. It is real. You're going to find, I think, for a lot of people, if you've never been, it's a lot smaller than you expected, but it's still quite thrilling. When I went from living in Illinois, where the weather changes every 30 minutes, or at least that's one of the many jokes that an Illinoisan who you know, was born, bred, and grew up around here would say, getting out there and having really nice weather, almost to the point of some days being too hot, was a bit of a shock. It was a bit of a change. I would also say, though, that if you want to do that drive, or let's say if you want to go from, you know, where you grew up and you want to see something completely and utterly different. Okay, I've done two major road trips in my life. One was going out to California and seeing the country from that perspective, you know, of, look, I grew up in middle America in Illinois, and I want to see everything going all the way out west. just the desert aesthetic was something I kind of eased into, I believe, when I got around New Mexico. And I just found it very peaceful and calming. You know, very easy to drive through. Nothing was too out of the ordinary. At the same time, though, you know, you just sort of start to appreciate this countryside that we get to, you know, see at home a little bit more, because I went from living in very green areas to living in not so green areas. So when I would go closer to Los Angeles and start seeing green trees in places, I felt like I was, like, closer to home, if that makes any sense.
No.
Like, I mean, if you've been to something like a Joshua Tree Park, like, it's a desert park with Joshua trees. It's very unique. It's something you'll see, you'll never forget, right? But when you're driving from a true desert, like, say, the Palm Springs area, and then you go into, you know, you have mountains around you, which is interesting, to say the least, because you're, like, in a desert, but there's mountains right next to you. When you start to first see, like, pine-like trees, you know, which, by the way, they have a lot of in, like, Northern California. There's a lot of forest. When you start seeing little patches of that as you get closer to a larger metropolitan area, you start to be like, wait a minute. Did I cross borders, state borders I shouldn't have? Like, where am I at here? But then you realize, nah, it's just the desert is a unique atmosphere in and of itself. And driving through it and living in it, I do miss it. I have to be honest with you from time to time, because I felt like it was a really interesting place to drive at night versus, you know, where I'm from, which is when you're driving at night, you really just have to watch for deer. Out there, that wasn't really a problem. They didn't really run through the desert like you would, you know, see around home and farmland and things like that, because the farmland out there is vastly different.
Wow.
The things they grow, the things that they work on, you know, maintaining, their products are very different than ours. Our soybean, corn, etc. Massive amount of product.
Well, we talk all the time about some of the benefits of this area, and granted, you don't have, it's that whole, right, wait 10 minutes, the weather's going to change, and we don't have,
yeah,
you know, the best weather in the winter, and you know, but it's kind of a badge of honor, you know, we accept the fact that we're kind of tough, and that it's cold and it's weary. Sure. But here's some of the upsides of it, too. You mentioned you won't necessarily have a deer, but we don't have, let's say, in the Southwest, you know, where you could have scorpions in your shoes or rattlesnakes or some of, yeah, those other things that are out there, is that we just, you know, and I know 312-981-7200, people will mention, we do have coyotes, and occasionally, you know, people will see a mountain lion or someone will say that, but, you know, we don't have, for the most part, we don't have a lot of tornadoes. You know, it's not like Oklahoma or Kansas where it's happening every right, year, every season. We don't have hurricanes. We don't have, you know, tidal waves and tsunamis, and there's a lot of things that we don't necessarily have here that other places have that they have to deal with on sort of the normal kind of danger side of things that they'll have to deal with. So let the listeners know, we're talking with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. He is talking, he's calling us from Peoria. We're talking about the road trip side. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about not only the destination where you end up getting to, but a lot of that stuff in the middle, maybe the world's largest ball of twine or some of those other attractions that you may see and get lured into along the way. So keep it here. We'll talk with Blake in just a second. It's staying on 720 WGN.
Somewhere beyond the sea.
720 WGN. It is Dane here with you, high atop Chicago. Tom Hush in the booth, spinning the hits, sort of a bumper savant, right? And I'm not sure if you chose this one, because we are talking about road trips, destinations, going someplace. Those places could be somewhere beyond the sea. I don't know. Or they could be Peoria. Who knows? And depending on the size of the sea, Blake Stubbs could be there in a boat. Blake, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Yeah.
So in the middle, were you? Now, you had destination in mind. You were going from point A to point out west. But, you know, that's why,
yes,
they have built those big billboards and all those roadside attractions and a lot of that stuff to,
mm-hmm,
to lure people into to their, I guess, web of entertainment. So when it came to that, were there things that you could either recommend, or did you just kind of power through, or did you stop and enjoy a little bit of the local color?
Well, it's funny. My drive out and my drive back were really power through drives because of work. So I was trying to get out there to start work, and then when work wrapped up there, then I came back and went right into another job. So while I didn't really get to stop and do a lot of the roadside attraction stuff, I mean, it's everywhere. That's very true. I mean, if you're looking for something to just kind of take your mind off the road, because let's be honest, like, when people get behind the wheel and they're going to do a long drive, long road trip style drive, sometimes it's best to not have a plan and other than the destination. And you can hit everything along the way and sort of take it in. And look, you're going to find all kinds of interesting slices of Americana when you do that. I, on the other hand, had a very set agenda, and so I had to get out there very quickly, aside from, you know, gas and hotel for sleep, because I did it in 2 days both ways. I found that I could have, you know, probably made it a 5-day drive if I wanted to, with the amount of stuff that I was, you know, able to stop for if I had the time. But I was, again, I was on very tight schedules. And I think you'll find that too. Like, sometimes you realize it was a road trip, but at the same time, it was like, no, I felt like I was just, it was just moving across country and back. But in the time of getting there and everything, there's a lot to take in just scenery wise, especially if you never grew up around mountains. Right? Like, you'll see mountains. You might take some mountain roads on your route to get there. I will say this, though. I did not have a planned route. I mean, I did have a guide in terms of the GPS, and I had looked at maps and kind of plotted how I wanted to get out to Southern California. But at the same time, I was like, I don't really want to feel too locked into this because I don't know what I'm going to miss out on.
Oh, wow.
And I think that there's something to take away from that. I think that's the way to do it if you're going to have a road trip where it's maybe it's you and the family, or maybe it's just you, or you and, you know, one other person, a best friend or a significant other. If you're going to do those things, you know, maybe just pick a destination, but how you get there, like the journey itself, and I believe that's like an old proverb as well. But, you know, it's the journey itself and what you encounter along the way. And if you're not in any kind of hurry, yeah, make those stops.
Oh,
check out the arts, you know, check out all those shops and, you know, attractions and things. If the biggest ball of yarn is there, go get a picture in front of it. Like, have fun with it, you know?
Hey. Wait, Tom's got a question.
Yeah. Hey, Blake, yeah. Have you ever been to the world's largest truck stop on I-80?
I have once, very quickly, to use the bathroom and then get back on the road.
But yeah.
Tom, what's so big about, is it just the fact that it's got the most amount of pumps? It's got the largest store, square footage of the lot? What about it? Is it multi-story? What about it makes it big?
You know, I won't lie to you. I don't have the specific stats on what makes that truck stop the largest truck stop in the world. It seems to have a lot of pumps. I don't know how many pumps a truck stop normally has.
Well, this would be more because it's
Whatever you think there should be there, maybe times 10, and then you've got the world's largest truck stop. But I was just shocked by how many cool things you could buy there. Like, you know, they've got like a Taco Bell and a Wendy's in there and stuff. But what really caught my eye was some of the trinkets. Like, you can get these beautiful candles that look like pies. Like, so they got like little strawberries in the pie. It looked like a real pie. We walked in. I was like, oh, cool. They sell pie here. And my girlfriend said, no, that's a candle.
That's America.
It was amazing.
Okay. So that's awesome. We should have a whole segment just about that. And so 312-981-7200, your best road trip, even if it is to that biggest truck stop. But now, Blake, there's also a cautionary tale that goes along with it. You could be lured in by those billboards that say, hey, you got to stop here, you got to stop there. But we all remember National Lampoon's Vacation, where even if the road isn't dangerous, you know, you may pull into that small town where the local sheriff/repair guy says how much you got, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I was going to say sheriff/mechanic/extortionist. Yeah, definitely. That's another thing, too. And I think that there's something to be said for, you know, you have that destination in mind, maybe take a few adventurous turns here and there based on the billboards. But here's the thing. If you're going to make those choices, typically those billboards come quite a ways out. If you have somebody in the car with you or van or whatever, do some Googling, you know, find out if this is legitimate. And if it's a legitimate right turn worthy, then take it and see what happens there. Because look, for all you know, the best meal of your life you could have at one of those places. You could find some really cool trinket. You could have a great family picture or just gag picture, whatever it may be.
Well, okay.
It's part of like adding on to the experience, right? Like, that's the whole drive.
Let the listeners know we're talking with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. Now, he has done one of the enviable trips, and I'm sure listeners 312-981-7200 that are thinking about maybe sharing your favorite road trip of all time. I think one of the ones everybody would want to do, it adds a little bit of danger into just the scenery and the local residents. You know, if it's wild animals or Kodiak bears or moose or whatever, you've actually taken a road trip across Alaska. How does someone, because for the most part, I don't know, that can you drive just straight to Alaska, or do you got to take one of those seaplanes and land there? How does that work?
So you can. What happened was, the reason I got to go was the first video project I ever worked on, outside of, you know, having a hobby of, like, you know, editing little short films for my comedy group in college. I met someone who was going up there to film wildlife, vegetation, landscapes. Basically, the idea was showcase Alaska on video and in photo in a way that everything is untouched by man. So, you know, we weren't there to interrupt. We were there to document. But to get there, I flew, and the person I worked for also flew. Now, years later, he would then get a large truck, trailer, and drive with family up there, and made it like a two-week trip through the U.S., Canada, all the way up to Alaska, and then stayed in a little town called Tok, T-O-K, Tok, Alaska. It has just the state trooper, like, outpost there, but there really is no other law. I don't believe they even have really a local government. It's just, there's like a grocery store, a couple restaurants, you know, a clothing store, and then everybody just kind of keeps to themselves. It's a nice, quiet community. Tok is also one of the spots in Alaska that, during certain parts of the year, will have the best weather in the entire state. As I remember it, because when I was there, it was incredibly, like, temperate. It was great. Not too humid. It wasn't too hot or too cold. But then it also can hit, like, minus 40 below. And so you'll see, like, you know, the nuts and bolts on, like, doors and stuff, like, freezing. So it can be very, you know, polar opposite in a lot of ways in terms of its weather. But what I ended up doing was, you know, I went to Valdez, Alaska. We filmed some, you know, I got to see otters in their natural habitat, like swimming around, seals, eagles. A lot of eagles were flying around up there, which is something you don't see every day in central Illinois. But on the same token, too, we went to Denali National Park. I ended up staying around the park there, and then we hiked on the tundra. So, I mean, look, Alaska is much more, if you're not just taking a cruise up there, you can make it much more of a robust outdoor-type trip, and that's really what mine was for 2 weeks living in an RV. We would just stay a couple of days in one location and move on to the next, and, you know, there's touristy elements to it. I actually ended up flying out of Talkeetna, which is a town that Northern Exposure, the television show, was based off of, or parts of it were based off of. But they have a airport there, which many communities in Alaska have, because a lot of people own planes, and that's how they get around. But there's a rescue crew that will actually fly people up on a glacier, and you can walk around at, like, an incredible elevation, and you find out you're walking on, like, thousands of feet of, like, 1,000 feet of snow, and then it's ice all underneath it. And but it's, like, rock solid, and they can land planes on it up there. And that was a pretty thrilling experience, to be able to fly around, you know, the mountains and just kind of take it all in. I have to be honest, like, getting back to Alaska is one of my life's ambitions. That trip was in 2007. I was in college. I was so impressionable and, like, interested in taking in everything around me. But now I'm like, I feel like I'd be way more interested in going now than when I was even then, because I was young. You know, I mean, it was a cool trip to me then, but now I feel like there's just a lot more, now that I've got some, you know, years and more experience on me, where I'm like, oh, I feel like I would take that in a whole other direction. You know, see some other locations. I didn't get to make it to the Arctic Circle. You know, so that's another thing. Going to a place on a road trip, I think, is cool, but you can always go back if you don't get to do everything you wanted to do. So I have a goal to get back there and see it again.
You wonder if, you know, as a younger guy, where you're just kind of taking it in, but maybe, like you had mentioned too, is that you're not, like, fully conscious of just how significant, how important, how powerful all of these things are. And then maybe also you're maybe not as maybe aware of just how kind of rugged and dangerous it is, because I would be thinking, you know, if it gets 40 below, and of course every single car has an electrical cord coming out the front because it freezes, and of course you've got wildlife and you've got bears, and if your car breaks down you could be eaten or freeze to death or whatever, is that there's just sort of an extra kind of level of danger kind of built into the whole scenario. I mean, you've got to respect the place. So Blake, hold tight, because we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, 312-981-7200, we're going to be able to take. Jill, hold on the line, and we've got a few other people. We're going to talk about other people's road trips that they're going to take, and then we're going to get a couple minutes from Blake. People are wondering, Wilford Brimley, one of our great actors, we've lost him. He's got thoughts on his career and his extended and almost unknown still existing life, right? So keep it here with Blake. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. Here, WGN, high atop Chicago, in for Nick until 4 a.m. and on the line with us back for a couple minutes. We have blockbuster Blake Stubbs. And the one thing, when we heard, of course, and thoughts and prayers to his family and, of course, all of his friends out there that Wilford Brimley had passed, I found it there are so many people, one of the kind of the common comments was that they thought he had died years ago. And when I looked up, I'm like, geez, Cocoon, when that came out, he was one of the elderly retirees that was about to die if he didn't have, you know, the alien egg to give him energy. He was only 49 when they were filming that that movie. So Wilford Brimley looked old his whole life.
He certainly had, in his career, he certainly had a look and a way. And I what I find when I look into actors' careers, I mean, certainly after they passed on, certainly there's films. We could all talk about our favorite Wilford Brimley film. And everyone probably knows him from the Quaker Oats commercials, and also from the American Diabetes Association, for which he was a spokesperson. For me, though, I like reading what directors and other actors have to say about them. You know, what was the impression that they left in the industry and the people that they worked with? Because, granted, I never met Wilford Brimley. However, I did, profoundly respect the work that he did, especially in quite a few films that I'm very partial to. And he's a guy who did everything. He did television. He did film. You know, the first credit that he has is for True Grit with John Wayne.
Wow.
Now, he had a minor role. He was uncredited, but that goes back to 1969. That was the first credit to his name. Now, you know, he was on The Waltons, which was a big hit in my house growing up. My mom was a big fan of that show. For me, I love him in John Carpenter's The Thing. And Carpenter posted an incredible tweet about how Wilford Brimley was basically the genuine article. He was a cowboy, he was a fine actor, and he was a darn good human being. That's the type of stuff you want to see about somebody who was 85 years old when they passed, had a wealth of credits to their name. In fact, he had 77 acting credits. There was a film that apparently he was scheduled to be in that was in pre-production, so apparently they will be replacing him in that. But, you know, he was a semi-retired actor here for the last few years. He had very few credits since 2009. He did two things in that year, and then he's only had three credits since. But, you know, 85 years old, he was in quite a few films, and I got to tell you, the one shot of Wilford Brimley that I'll never get out of my head, as much as I love him in The Thing, it will come from John Woo's Hard Target, where I have to say Wilford Brimley is the inspiration for the Lonely Island song, Good Guys Don't Look at Explosions, because he's riding a horse as a massive building explodes behind him, and he did the stunt because he was an expert, you know, horse rider. He was expert on horseback. So just that kind of guy, the genuine article, you know, go look for negative stories about Brimley. You won't find him. He had a storied career. Great guy. Apparently
he seemed, but he always seemed like he was like, he would be typecast as sort of the curmudgeon. Like he always seemed, cause he was kind of crabby. Right. And Blake, we're all, I think, fans of John Carpenter's The Thing. And Tom and I were talking before we went on about him in that movie. When you think of that movie, what is a scene that comes to mind? And we'll see if it matches up with what we were thinking.
For me, my favorite Brimley moment in The Thing is when he's in the shed in isolation and you know that he has been inhabited by The Thing, and there's the noose hanging and he says, I don't want to be out here anymore. There's like a genuine, like, it's like The Thing got being human right. Because it's very hard to watch because you don't want to leave the guy out there, but you got to leave the guy out there. And that's Brimley. I mean, that was it. He totally had a great grasp of the scene work that he was doing. If you ever get a chance and you're a fan of The Thing, but you don't have like a personalized copy with a great, commentary track on it, there is a commentary track that's done by Carpenter and Kurt Russell, who, Dane, you know, I'm a big fan of Kurt Russell.
Sure.
But Russell is cackling through the entire thing, laughing so hard because there's so many fun stories about when they were making that movie, which, by the way, they, you know, by all accounts, they didn't know if it was going to work. I mean, it was a special effects, you know, nightmare in a lot of ways, but also a special effects innovation, you know, type film in a lot of ways. So there's just a lot of humor, but there's not a single moment where they don't see Brimley. And he's just like the light of their eye. And you can just tell that they're enjoying talking about him. The other great scene of him is when he's going crazy, breaking everything, because Carpenter just put two cameras on him and said, go crazy. Go absolutely crazy. And Russell, when he comes in, the end of it is when he, you know, pushes a table with him to try to get him to stop being violent. And he's like, yeah, I had to be very careful not to slam him into the wall, but he told me, just come at me. You know, just do what you got to do. And I think, you know, that's one film of many, but Brimley was the kind of guy where, for a lot of people, he's a character actor. But for people who adore character actors, he was so much more than that.
Yeah.
He brought so much to the screen. He brought so much to the way he delivered his lines. There was a lot to say about the presence that he brought to the screen, whether it was a film, the big screen, or the small screen at home. Because, you know, he did everything. He did TV, he did movies, TV movies. He was an actor's actor, I guess, in a lot of ways. That's the easiest way to describe it. He was truly an actor's actor and a downright good human being, as you'll find when you start reading about people who worked with him and what they had to say about being around him on set and in creating, you know, and being artists with him.
Yeah, and he'll be missed. And of course, that whole setup up there would be like that's what it reminds me of, is if I took a road trip to Alaska, I'd end up, you know, with a Wilford Brimley type character locked in a shed asking me, saying, I'm okay. Like, let me out. Well, Blake, we're going to let you get back to it. And thanks so much for sharing more than just movies, which is, of course, those great road trips. And we're going to talk with some of the listeners about those. You've inspired some people to get in on things. Sure. So I appreciate it. And of course, give your social media so people can follow your adventures, continue that conversation on road trips or movies.
If you want to chat with me a bit more, you can find me on Twitter at Blake Stubbs, BlakeStubbs.
Blake Stubbs. Thanks, Blake. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Have a great one.
All right. And so 312-981-7200, if you have a road trip that you got a chance to take, or one that you would suggest for the listeners, especially now when kind of travel and vacations and kind of getting out there is more difficult than ever. Some of the obvious choices aren't available, but some of those great choices are available and people are doing that. We've got Jill on the line. Jill, welcome to the show.
Hiya. So when I was a kid, I was about 4 or 5, we took a car ride to Mount Rushmore in South Dakota. And one of my parents' friends said, now there were 3 of us, okay, and I was the youngest, and I always had to sit on the hump. And it was a Pontiac Ventura, so it was the mid-70s. And it was a 14-hour drive, and my parents' friend said, oh, you know what, just drive at night, the kids will sleep. Not a problem. It'll be an easy drive. We were so excited. He didn't sleep at all. All 3 of us were up the whole time. And then when we got there, one of the day trips we were going to take was to, they had this this bedrock, the city of Bedrock. It was like remade up there.
Like the Flintstones? And
it was yeah.
Okay.
It was really cool. But the whole day we argued, the 3 of us, about who was going to drive the car. Because one of the rides was to ride Barney's car or Fred's car. And when we got in, there's already a ride operator driving the car for you. So we wasted all half our day arguing about who was going to drive the car.
It turns out no one's going to drive the car. Now, this was back in the day. Now, we've got 3 kids, and so they've got tablets and phones, and they can kind of stay mm-hmm. occupied, and they just kind of look at that. When you were a kid, and when I was a kid, we didn't have that, and so you had to kind of, if you were awake and excited about something, you sort of had to manage not only your boredom, but car sickness and just the time. Did you do any of those, like, look out the window games, like Punch Bug, or what kind of things did you do to pass the time while you were
well, a lot of times, well, we listened to the radio, and we loved, like, listening to the local radio stations, as, you know, because that's what you used to do before satellite. You used to just listen to all the local radio stations as you went through each state. And so that was kind of fun to hear, like, the different radio stations, what had a similar format, what, you know, there were some, you know, states that had only country music was dominant. You know, it's just kind of a cool thing. And we used to look at, we used to play bingo, like with the not bingo, but like with the alphabet, where you try, I see an A, yeah, I see a B, you know, and, yeah, and that sort of thing. So it was just, you know, we passed the time, but.
And the last thing is, like, as far as like the eating and the stopping, when we talked with Blake, like he was busy trying to get from point A to point B, so it was tough to kind of lure him into some of those things. But as far as like roadside places to stop, did you guys do like any kind of Howard Johnson's or Stuckey's or any of that kind of stuff?
Stuckey's was yeah, Stuckey's and Howard Johnson's. I remember those pretty well. And then every once in a while you find like a mom and pop place. You know, hole in the wall kind of diner, and they always had like the best food.
That's it. All right. Well, thanks, Jill. Appreciate you weighing in.
Sure.
All right. 312-981-7200. Your favorite road trips of all time. We're going to take a break in a couple minutes, but I'm trying to think, like, Tom, did you ever do that whole get in the car family truckster thing and,
oh, man,
like head off someplace?
No, not really.
What do you mean?
We flew a lot of places. Like I did a lot of international travel.
That doesn't count. That's
not... I know that it's not exactly a road trip, but listen, there's no road that goes to Venice. You know, there's just, you got to fly.
You got to.
Or take a ship.
You got to fly. Well, 312-981-7200, the inspiration that's out there. If you've got a road trip recommended or something that you've done that you could suggest to the listeners. And I've done like a bunch of those road trips, and we're doing them now, like with the kids, because the you know, our in-laws live down in Florida, in the Villages. Of course, you wouldn't want to go there now because, of course, the quarantine and all that kind of stuff. But you take those trips down there, and it's gotten so much, I don't want to say easier, as far as just kind of being able to do it. I think as you get a little bit older, but when you're a kid, it was hard, man. If it was 3, 4 hours, 5 hours, that seemed like almost an eternity. And if you didn't have, see, now you've got satellite radio, which you're able to kind of tune into things that you sort of like. If you were left to kind of just, I don't know, because we are so blessed, you know, people here in Chicago, to be able to have a bunch of different stations, whether it's talk stuff or country, you know, whatever kind of music you want, you can find something. But as you get out a little bit into the world, it's a little tougher.
It's a lot of, and the Lord said, you know, and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, there's a bunch of things. 312-981-7200. We're going to touch on some of those. Plus, we're going to talk about some of your first jobs ever. We were talking off the air a little bit about that, and I think Nick had talked about maybe some summer jobs that are going on. But if you've got a first, kind of a crazy first job, doesn't have to be the exact first job, but if it's one of those first jobs that you had, kind of introducing yourself into the workforce, but in something a little non-traditional, you can go ahead and share that with us as well. We've got a couple to share. I know Tom's got a great one, and I've got a couple as well. So road trips that you took, whether it was with the family or ones that you'd suggest people can take now, especially during the pandemic, or if you have a crazy first job that you had that you want to share, that would be something that would be interesting as well. 312-981-7200. Quick break. It's staying here with you, 720 WGN. This is Hall & Oates. Nice. All right, 720 WGN. Is Dane here in for Nick until 4 a.m. And excited to talk about a couple different topics before we get to. We're going to have the historian for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway talk about the history as they change history, and we kind of get into that 500 that's going to come a little bit later this month. We're going to have Murr from Impractical Jokers on with us as well. We've got a couple topics that we're kind of talking about that have been kind of road trips as people kind of get out there and try to figure out some things to do, places to go during the pandemic, and some of those suggestions that people had. And then through the process of just kind of talking about things, Tom and I had kind of talked about something that was similar to something that Nick had brought up as far as jobs, odd jobs. And we were talking about some of your first jobs, some of the first jobs that you've ever had. So 312-981-7200, doesn't have to be super crazy, but that helps, right? That's more funny. So I think that one of the first jobs I had was detasseling corn, which is, if you've ever heard of doing that, it's, you kind of walk through a cornfield and you kind of just detassel it and break it off. Very kind of at one with nature sort of farming stuff. And then one of the first ones that was kind of odd that you and I talked about is I was like a flower delivery guy in college. And so I had the opportunity to deliver flowers. Now, this is when you look at a job you know, as far as if people are happy to see you, if you're, I think, delivering, you know, subpoenas, maybe people aren't as happy to see you. Or if you're a code enforcement officer, maybe not so much. But flowers, people are usually happy to get flowers. And so all in all is a relatively, you know, kind of pleasant existence. Got a couple tips here and there. You're making people happy. One of the odd parts about that job was also is that the florist that I was working with, I had to deliver to the funeral homes in the area. So a number of different funeral homes in different neighboring towns. And so we had keys to all the funeral homes. So I would have to go and set up the flowers. You know, I'd have a van, I'd be by myself, I'm driving to this place. And oftentimes, since I had the keys, there wasn't even the funeral people weren't even there. So you would just go, you'd let yourself in, and then you'd have to set up. And sometimes it was, you know, just one little pot of something or whatever. And then some, you know, sometimes it was a pretty ornate, you know, kind of a complicated setup, might take you 15 minutes or so to set the thing up. And there would be a, you know, a deceased person there that you did not know. Now, normally, at least at that point, I think probably for most people, unless you're sort of a homicide investigator or something, you're not oftentimes coming into contact with, you know, people that are dead or deceased that you don't know, right? And if it's your family, then you kind of get that. And there's a whole other dynamic of kind of familiarity and sadness that kind of gets into it. But when it's a complete stranger and you're there by yourself in a room with them, and you're setting stuff up. And sometimes there wasn't, like I said, no one from the funeral home was there. There certainly wasn't any other people. So I would find myself, Tom, talking to the person, just kind of like, hey, I'm just going to go set these flowers up over here. You know, it wasn't that
your
I thought.
Your family sure likes you.
Well, you know,
bouquet.
Well, I think it was customary. What I would typically do is I would offer some condolences, you know, like, it sucks. You know, I don't know what you say.
You turn to a dead guy and just said, yeah, tough break, buddy.
Well, I mean,
you know?
I don't know why, but I felt like the need to at least address them, you know, because they're there, sure, in the room. And so I was able to, like, you know, but then it was still weird. So you have to turn your back on them. There's no one else there. We've all seen enough, you know, movies where somebody, you know, pops up and, you know, or whatever.
Well, that'd be my greatest fear. Is that if so help me God, one noise comes from behind me from that casket, I'm out.
Well, I wanted to make some kind of a, you know, connection, like an understand, like just say, hey, you know, I'm just here to do this. You know, I'm on team.
I get that.
I'm on team you, you know.
Team John Smith.
Sometimes it would have that. And thankfully, it was all people that felt like at least you could say that they lived, you know, a pretty full life. It was, you know, we did
generally
it
on the older end.
They kind of skewed a little bit. It wasn't any like kids or anything like that, which would have been, I think, as crazy as
depressing.
It sounds, more it would be more scary. You know? Well, certainly depressing, but I think I just would have been more scared. So we were able to work through that. But that was kind of an odd job.
Yeah, that's funeral homes are really weird. I've always been kind of had a weird energy from funeral homes, because usually when you walk into a funeral home, that top level is quite nice. You know, it's very, you know, well furnished.
I didn't know there's like a sort of hierarchy of levels in the funeral world.
Well, I mean, they have I don't know if the word is a crypt. They have a body locker downstairs. Oh, you know that, right?
I thought you were saying like, well, do you want to go to the Beauregard room, you know, the nicer room with the better stuff, and then that's up higher. You just meant like, hey, it's normal, you know,
it's normal
house plants and chairs, and then below it's a dungeon a dungeon.
Dead guys. I accidentally went down into the dead guy room one time.
For what reason? What were you doing? Oh, is this the wrong term
I was at a wake. You know, I was at a wake. I go to wakes every once in a while.
Sure, of course, yeah.
It wasn't a close family member, but, you know, you pay respects, you know, you sample the tea and coffee that they have and everything like that. But I was trying to find my way to the bathroom, and I asked one of the funeral directors or something. I was like, oh, excuse me, where's your washroom? He's like, one here, but I think it's occupied. So
why don't you go down where we wash the bodies? Yeah. Is that what he said?
No, he said there's another one downstairs. There's another one downstairs, because the one up near the actual funeral rooms, the parlors, right. it was being used. So instead of taking the stairs, there was an elevator right nearby. I was like, okay, well, I'll take that one. And I, you know, get in the elevator. I wasn't sure which button to hit. And I figured, well, this is ground level.
He said downstairs.
He said downstairs. There's a button here that says B. I'm guessing that means basement, but I'm guessing the basement, they might have, you know, something down there, a restroom or something like that. So I go down, And
what was that like? That's kind of...
Well, I felt like I was going to walk out and be like, ah, yes, the restroom where I can go and do my business. get down. The doors open. It's completely dark.
Don't tell me just yet, because I'm thinking in my mind a lot of just like bare concrete kind of stuff. Like they wouldn't.
Well, I couldn't even see what it was in front of me.
Oh, geez.
So I was like, well, this is weird. And I go ahead and I pull out my cell phone, which has a flashlight on the back.
This sounds like,
and I'm dead. I'm 100%. 100% pull out my cell phone so I can look for a light, so I can look for a switch, and I'm panning my flashlight around, and all of a sudden I come across a toe.
What? No way.
Yeah, foot, toe tag, and everything.
Really?
Yeah.
So now, was this a, did you feel like was it an refrigerated area? Because normally,
I guess so. I don't know. I didn't really notice. Controlled. It must have been, but I immediately panicked. This all happened in the space of about a minute. But so 60 seconds, I'm in the elevator, I'm in the basement, none of the lights are on, I pull out my cell phone, it's literally just a single motion, just like, oh, okay, let's see, where's the light around here? Body with a toe tag on it. I immediately ran, I jumped back into the elevator, started smashing the up button, and I was like, nope, can't handle this, at all.
That's traumatic.
It was really weird. I mean, granted, I was like 14. I was 14, 15, so it's not like I hadn't. Yeah, it didn't destroy my psyche. But it wasn't helpful.
You know what? And I don't know, like the typical funeral home, like what, like how much is, you know, going on. You know, I don't know if there's always like people backed up. Oh, I'm so busy today. I've got to involve like 10 people, or if it's, you know, I think some places obviously are busier than others, but I don't know how it is. And you ever know, like if you've ever been in the kitchen of some restaurants, as opposed to like what the front of the house looks like, may look all organized and whatever, and then the back could be crazy. You know, there could be a, you know, a big tub of sauce that's holding a door open or whatever, right? It doesn't have that whole kind of
put together feeling.
Yeah, the put together feeling. Like they got people stacked up in the back.
You know what they say, Dane? Never learn how sausages are made, or laws are made, or how bodies are embalmed. I think that's the same.
You added the bodies embalmed. Yeah,
you know, never learn how sausages or laws are made, and nor find out how bodies are embalmed, because it is a necessary but somewhat grim process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, a lot of formaldehyde, if I've been told correctly, but I don't know if that's modern.
No, I think so. 312-981-7200,
funeral directors out there
that want to share exactly how that kind of stuff works. But you were able to get back up into the welcoming arms of your bereaved, you know, family or friends or whatever. So it wasn't as though you were just stuck in this place all by yourself.
I was able to get immediately back up. And,
so that was just an experience that's a little bit crazy. But that wasn't one of your first jobs. So one of your first jobs was actually something that a lot of people have had, you know, some kind of contact with, but who's actually worked at one? I don't know anybody else who's worked at, it was a dry cleaners, right?
Yeah, I worked at a dry cleaner / laundromat. So we would do regular laundry too, for the most part. If it's something didn't need to be dry cleaned, we would just wash it, you know, press your shirts and everything like that. The typical, sort of place. There's a lot that goes into working at dry cleaners, and it's always like 200 degrees. It's always super duper hot, no matter what.
Well, and
I worked there for a summer too, so it was hot outside and it was hotter inside.
Is there anything super dangerous about it? Because there's some jobs that you don't necessarily think of as dangerous, but I always looked when I would see sort of this, if we'll remember, and of course, listeners, if you can think of it, you know, that whole kind of conveyor belt of clothes that's all sort of moving, that someone could get caught on one of those, or maybe like one of the heat presser things, and then you've got all these crazy chemicals, right?
Yeah, I don't recall anybody getting super maimed, but there were probably, you know, a few heat accidents here. You burn yourself every once in a while, maybe get some chemical on your pants and they stain or turn color, like they get bleached or something like that. Most of the time I had to wear I had to wear bandages on my thumbs a lot, because I had this I would have to tag the laundry, because it was an overnight laundry, so
I always have that little kind of white tag that's got a reference number, right?
Reference number, like a valet for your clothes. But it was one of those things where if you dropped off your clothes by, I want to say, I don't know, 11 in the morning, they would be done the next day. So we had to move quickly because everybody's running into this dry cleaners to get in before 11 so they get their shirts the next day. If you get it after 11, you have to wait like a full, you know, cycle or something like that. But they can guarantee next day if you bring it in before 11. So I used to, it was like almost a needle, and I would often poke myself in the thumb, you know, trying, you know, you take the clothing tag, that's where you put the reference tag. And I once accidentally tagged my own finger. I put a laundry tag through my own thumb, and it was like that for 2 hours. Because they were just like, well, just go wash it off. I was like, yeah, but I have to get the tag out of my thumb. And they were like, don't worry, just put on a glove for a bit. I was like, okay, but I still have to get this tag out of my thumb.
Look at that, that dedication to the workplace, dealing with not only bodily harm, physical harm, danger, right? Chemicals and all that kind of stuff.
And that's just the customers. You know?
And that's just the customers. 312-991-7200, your thoughts on minimum of those early jobs and also the road trips, and we were doing that as well. When we come back from the news, we're going to have, you talk about roads and trips and history. Donald Davidson, the historian for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, is going to be joining us to talk a little bit about the history of the past and the brand new future coming up with the Indy 500. It's Dane here, 720 WGN.
Bottom line, there's been 6 times that it wasn't held, 17 and 18, and then 42 through 45. But since then, through all of this history, with occasional postponements and delays by rain, it has never gone later than May the 31st. We've never gone to June 1, so this will make history this year. Hi, this is Donald Davidson. I'm the historian with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and you're on the road with Dane on WTN. It has a presence about it. And I believe that. I think the place has vibes because so much has happened here.
720 WGN on the road with Dane, typically high atop Chicago in the Skyline Studios, but now, of course, in the broadcast bunker as we kind of wait out in anticipation for all of those things that we know and love. And when it comes to the world of sporting, when it comes to the world of motorsport, is the things happening in Indianapolis. On the line with us, excited to have a guy since 1964, has worked in and around in writing and radio and television around the most iconic sporting venue in the world, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And now, of course, he is the IMS Foundation track historian. He is with us, the one and only Donald Davidson. Donald, welcome to WGN.
Thank you, sir, very much.
Well, it's great to have you, and I know when it comes to history, in a little bit we talked off the air, of course, Indianapolis, when it comes to motorsports, unparalleled, and when it comes to radio, you know, we've been around, you know, almost 100 years as well ourselves.
Absolutely. In fact, the first major station to broadcast from the Indianapolis Speedway was WGN. Apparently, from what we've been able to find, in 1922, there were two attempts at broadcasting, but they were little more than ham radio operators. And the first station of note was WGN from Chicago in 1924. And they had a broadcaster named Quinn Ryan who did the early broadcast. They didn't do the whole race, but they would do a little bit at the beginning, you know, like 15 minutes before the start, 15 minutes in. And then they would do the finish and maybe just little updates in between. But that goes back, well, you know, the 500 was first held in 1911, but they didn't have radio yet.
Oh, my gosh. That is amazing. Well, you know, as part of the DNA of WGN has always been sports. Exciting to hear that connection as well. I'm going to have to mention that all the time. Quinn Ryan is one of the members of WGN's illustrious Walk of Fame, so one of those kind of pioneer broadcasters. Yep. And cool to see that he's got that connection with the Brickyard. So, you know, the famous slogan that you always hear and you as part of your radio show that you do in May is,
Is it May yet? Is everyone as excited and looking forward to May as it starts that whole kind of lead up to the 500? It's been replaced now with is it August yet? And we're hoping basically that that's even something that can hold true. I remember my first time walking into Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and it wasn't necessarily just about the racing that was going to happen or the racing on the track. It was just the structure itself. It's breathtaking and amazing. And if you can talk a little bit about, as a guy who has made his entire career the passion of sharing the history of the Speedway, what was your kind of first impressions as you and Indy first met?
Well, I pretty much knew what to expect, so it's a little hard to explain that. I'm actually British, although it doesn't sound like it anymore. And I became aware of the Indianapolis 500 in this foreign country when I was just entering my teens, and for some reason there was a fascination there. I had to send away to get information about it because the Brits didn't know much about the Indianapolis 500 then. There was no foreign participation. Anyway, so it became an obsession with me, and so when I finally had saved up enough money to make the trip, it wasn't a casual visit, and so I pretty much knew the lay of the land and what to expect, but it was rather surreal to be walking in and be able to get into the garage area. It was rather like, Dorothy and The Wizard of Oz when everything turns to color. Wow. And that changed my life forever. I think probably the biggest surprise I had was how friendly the participants were. I was really amazed by that. I thought drivers would all be very, very intense individuals, and I was amazed at how friendly and easygoing most of them were. So I pretty much lived the dream, and now right now we're kind of living in the twilight zone because, as you said, it's always been this huge build-up, and there's tens of thousands of people, spectators, that their whole year evolves around the Indianapolis 500. And they've been going for 30, 40, 50 years, and they have their traditions and where they sit and what they wear and all this stuff. And they're going to have to change that this year because it will be in August. And people will say, well, that doesn't really matter, does it? Yes, it does, because the light will be different and the shadows will be in different places. It just it'll take a little getting used to.
We think of these as unprecedented times, and in a lot of ways they are. When it comes to the Speedway, the Speedway has been around for a long time through lots of trials, tribulations, challenges throughout history. Are there other times, and I'm thinking maybe during wars or things like that, where either the race was either changed, moved, postponed, or maybe just canceled?
Yeah, it was not held. In 1917 and 18, they were down because of World War One, and the infield was an aviation depot. Oh, wow. And then 1942 through 45, shut down again. And this time it was actually, the infield was offered to the government, but it had been fined for landing and taking off with World War One aircraft, but by World War II it was outmoded. So the thing just sat there and fell into a terrible, deplorable condition. But anyway, the bottom line, there's been six times that it wasn't held, 17 and 18, and then 42 through 45. But since then, it's been held every year. And for many years, it was May the 30th, regardless of the day of the week on which it fell. So up until 1971, the 500 would be on Tuesday or Thursday or whenever that fell, except for Sunday, in which case they go to Monday, May 31st. But anyway, since with all of that, through all of this history, and with occasional postponements and delays by rain, yeah, it has never gone later than May the 31st. We've never gone to June 1, so this will make history this year.
It is history, but there are so many people that are committed to having it happen. And when you hear this, think about it, and we'll let the listeners know we're talking with IMS Foundation historian Donald Davidson, is when you hear about things like the Olympics or the NBA or the Final Four, some of these iconic sporting events happening, and then you think, well, how does that affect what can happen with you know, with the Indianapolis 500, it's hard to even imagine. But I think that commitment, because you mentioned some of those people, and it is, it's a badge of honor, no pun intended. I know the badges that are such a big part of the festivity, but people do say that there is almost this kind of rivalry among fans saying, well, I've been here for 40 years, or this is my 35th time that I've attended. People are committed to this. There's almost no way they'll cancel it.
I don't know how many times I began to notice this, well, a long time ago, but I've discussed it with all kinds of people, and it's just astonishing to me that people will tell you how many times they've gone. And just what you gave a perfect example there, but throughout the year for me, but certainly on the weekend of the race, two days before the race and on the day before the race, where people are arriving and coming into the museum, it seems like everybody will tell you, this is my 37th year, it's my 42nd year, 51st, whatever it is. I wonder if there's another event of any kind in the world where people will do that. And of all of the other major events, there is a similarity that somebody pointed out, and I agree because I've now experienced it. There's a great similarity between the Kentucky Derby and the Indianapolis 500. And I think maybe the connection is that it is the same event at the same time of year at the same location, because when you think about it, everything else, you know, baseball teams get bought and sold and move, and you know, the Olympics is every 4 years, and you know, the Super Bowl or World Series, whatever, is always in different locations, whereas this is the same place every year at the same time, except for this year, of course.
Donald, that's an incredible point, because we've brought it up. It is one of those sporting events that people who aren't even maybe the most avid motorsports fans are still aware of. It. It's on the bucket list of almost everyone, just like, let's say, the Kentucky Derby, even though for the most part, people aren't all, you know, horse racing enthusiasts. And I think that's it. And part of it is because it is so much more than the event. It's hard to take away because so much exciting stuff happens on the track, obviously, but it is so much bigger than that. It's an event that transcends the sport that it represents. And because I think of the venue as well, because Indianapolis, I got to tell the listeners too, is that it's one thing to go there on a race day and a race weekend. It's like nothing. Motorsports in general is hard to match in person, as opposed to watching it on television, as good as they've gotten with it. But Indianapolis is different in ways, because there is so much to see, so much history, so much going on. So let's talk a little bit about people, or ways that people, once, of course, we get past this, before we get into some of the online stuff, and that's going to be a big focus, is the museum there. I mean, there's so much history. It's definitely, it's a tourist attraction, whether there's a race or not.
Oh, certainly. And by the way, I agree with everything that you just said. I mean, I'm nodding and saying, yep, I agree with everything that you said there. And you know, you've got that large, probably, I don't know, tens of thousands of people that go, that maybe it's the only automobile race of the year that they go to. Now, the museum is open normally. It's closed right now. It's normally open every day of the year, but Christmas and Thanksgiving. But it's astonishing that there's always people in the museum, and it doesn't matter whether it's October the 13th or February the 9th, there'll be people in the museum. And the percentage of overseas people is just amazing. They've got a way to, well, they've got a touch thing now. It used to be that you wrote your name in a book, but they would have these books, page after page after page, and, you know, Japan, Australia, Sweden, Norway. And maybe people had a very casual interest. Maybe they really didn't know. Maybe they couldn't name a single 500 winner. But they come to the museum, and I've had people say that when you come into the track, well, a lot of people say this, that there's a presence, and that I'll name drop a little bit. Tony Orlando was at the museum for a function several years ago, and he said, you know, I've never been here, but when I came through the tunnel, he said, it was like when I went to the Colosseum in Rome. It has a presence about it. And I believe that. I think the place has vibes because so much has happened here. But again, it's just that it's a destination that you go to the Indianapolis Speedway, and maybe you really don't know anything about racing. So it's just, it's amazing that, I don't know what the percentage of overseas people would be, but it's probably 30%, I would think.
Wow.
Maybe higher on a year-round basis.
I wonder if that is at the Indianapolis or the Speedway Indiana Visitor and Tourism Bureau that's out there working it, or is it, like you said, it's just kind of the magic of either all that history, what it represents in the world of racing for sure, but also in the world, in just the Americana. And I think about this, is there are drivers from that have had success in all yeah. other disciplines of racing that is one of the things that they want to find a way to get to and compete in and hopefully win. So even in the world of motorsports, Indianapolis and success there transcends even success in other areas of it, which I don't think is the case. I don't think that, you know, Joe Montana is wanting to go win a World Cup, you know, or something else in a different just discipline as far as what it is he's doing on the athletic side. So as a guy that never gets surprised, because you know everything, you're the historian. Before we get to the online stuff, has it ever surprised you of who has been drawn there, whether it's from walks of notoriety or maybe, I know there's just movie stars and rock stars and presidents and everybody.
Yes. That's very interesting. Little editorial here. A lot of dignitaries have come here, but sometimes they're the guests of somebody. The ones that I'm interested in, the ones that like it and come anyway. And a line I used to hear quite a bit was when a dignitary would come in and say, well, it's, you know, great pleasure to be here. I've never had the opportunity to come before. And I said, yes, you did. You've had the opportunity every year, but you didn't have somebody paying your way or bringing you in as a guest. And forgive that being facetious there. But James Garner.
Nice. All right.
Came probably 30 times. He would occasionally have to miss one, but he over a 45-year period or so, he probably went more than 30 times. And I don't know if you remember Kent McCord. Kent McCord, I think, has missed 1 year since 1968, and he comes and he's very, very low key. He's not out there. He doesn't ride in the parade. He's not signing autographs. He just comes and sits in the stands because he likes it. And so to distinguish between the people that truly were enthusiasts and the ones who came once and said all the right things, probably James Garner would be way up there. Paul Newman, of course, got involved as a car owner with Carl Haas up in from Highland, just a little bit north of where you are. And then old Mel Torbe was a huge fan and came many times. I could go through the whole list, but it just always amused me when somebody would say, I've never had the opportunity to be here before. Yes, you have. You had it every year.
Yeah.
But you were at the lake or doing something else.
But also, too, is just kind of the diversity of notoriety, right? You'll have on that same day in May, you'll have, you know, presidents and A-list movie stars and the biggest musicians and all that kind of stuff there with the backdrop of not only the Speedway, but all the action. So for all those people that could barely make it to May and now have to make it to August, you're kind of the gatekeeper of what can help them kind of make it through. And this is really fascinating stuff. So let's talk a little bit about the online archive. I know it's going to be 13 weeks. There's going to be different things released, but what are people going to get? What are people going to see? What are they going to be surprised by?
Well, I don't know what they'd be surprised at, but the thing is that, there's material that I have that I've written is up there, but I didn't create the thing. I tell people I'm a historian. I live in the dark ages, and I've done up on modern technology. But some fellows have created this thing, an archive. And what they plan to do, because it's ripe for everybody's looking for content. I mean, if you watch TV and it's the 1999 Masters or the Game 6 of the World Series or whatever. And so this is a look back, but they've decided to do a decade every Tuesday. And so they just released the second batch. And there's just highlights from the decade. And then there's some general information about how the place got started. There's like a little mini bio on the four founders. There's all kinds of different things that you can jump to. There's some iconic photographs. And just to kind of whet your appetite, and it's only just really scratching the surface, because I think they put up 9 iconic photos. Well, in the entire collection, when you could get to it, which we really don't have much access to it right now, I think there's like 4 million images, and it's just vast. And so I think the idea is just sort of to tell general stories, the fellows are telling me that the average length of time that somebody stays on it is like many, many minutes. So they're not just quickly looking at the pictures and going to something else. They're actually reading the stories. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the material has appeared in the past. I mean, they're resurrecting several things that I've written for the program over the years. And so it's sort of like getting a second go around. But I've always enjoyed telling anecdotes, and I tell people I'm not a gearhead, and I'm not into controversy, and I don't know much about, you know, turbochargers and other stuff, but I'm interested in the people and the human interest mm-hmm. stories, and I just want to jump in here and to give a salute to WGN again. I mean, radio was king. And much of the popularity, I mean, radio wasn't even in existence as we know it when the race started, but certainly through the 30s and 40s and the 50s, probably the 50s the most, the impact that radio had and the fact that it popularized the event, and especially in the 50s and the 60s, when there were so many people overseas in the service that could tune into the Armed Forces Network and hear the race on the radio. Just radio just had a huge impact.
That's great to hear, the power of radio. We know that, of course, here at WGN, we reached 38 states and Canada at night, so it would have been a vast listening audience that would have been able to kind of get in on some of that excitement. And mm-hmm. and you bring it up on the history side of it, and we'll get that website, is that Indianapolis Motor Speedway is so much more than just the stats. You talk about people kind of interacting with the things online, and it is more than just, okay, well, who won here? You're trying to find out a fact there. There are so many stories that have so much more to them than just, you know, the actual results on the track. And
Yes. I always say the box score doesn't tell the story.
It does.
And I've been blessed personally to have been around a while and been befriended by the participants. And when I first showed up a long time ago, you know, there was pre-World War I participants still around. I mean, I spent time with Ray Haroon, who won the race in 1911. I was just a kid, and he was this elderly gentleman. And I was able to visit him several times, and he taught me all kinds of stuff firsthand. I've been just being blessed. I just love the stories about the people.
Let the listeners know we're talking with Donald Davidson. He is the historian for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And so the website where people can get the information and kind of get on there, of course, there's going to be new stuff over the course of the 13 weeks as they kind of tackle each decade with things. But we'll have links up at WGNradio.com with that. So we'll have links for it. Last thing, and this is one of the things, is I don't think that there's a better person to be the historian and sharing and kind of that archive, that repository for all of that, the enthusiasm and the passion and all the information on those stories. One of the other things that I think is unique about Indianapolis is that, and you mentioned talking with some of the participants in the original, you know, winners of the race and things like that, is that outside of having fans and a fan base that just reveres the facility and their times and memories that are there, is that the participants themselves, the people who've won it, are sometimes the best ambassadors, because, and not just because, hey, I won, I was successful. You know, Mario Andretti has won a lot of races in a lot of different places, but he gets it, and everyone else gets it too. There is this respect for what it is and what it means. Yes. And I think that is tremendous. And as Indianapolis Motor Speedway, I think, goes into a new era with new ownership, maybe new activities, maybe new things happening there, I know there's a lot of buzz and excitement. What are your thoughts, Donald Davidson, about It's always talking about the history and the past. What are your thoughts if you could look into that crystal ball for the future?
Well, I don't do the future, but picking up on something that you've said, that the number of drivers that come back every year, and they're welcomed, by the way, and this is something astonishing. Sometimes they have an autograph session on the afternoon before the race, and it's for anybody who drove in the race, and they probably, and sometimes we've had 100 people show up. And I think typically it's probably 60 to 70 people that just drove in the race one time. And those are the people that the autograph seekers want. Because they've got Mario, and they've got Foyt, and they've got Elio Castroneves. They need the guy that ran once in 1978 and finished 33rd, and I'm just doing a hypothetical. But these fellows show up, and the winners typically, well, a lot of them are still involved with teams and so forth. But if you want to, the rank and file, for want of a better term, they show up at their own expense, and they got a credential for them and their spouse, but they make their way here, and they take care of their own lodging to sit out there and sign autographs for nothing. And is there another faction of motorsport or any sport in the world, and I don't want to get myself in trouble and mention a team, but think of a sporting organization, and the invitation goes out that we'd like for you to come here and pay your own way and take care of your own lodgings to come here and sign autographs for a couple of hours. And, oh, by the way, it doesn't pay anything.
Oh, man.
How many people do you think would do that? But the drivers do that because they love it. And they some of them that were never quite in the limelight, but they did drive in the 500 once, and they'll say it changed their life, they sign autographs. And they're having as much fun as the people who are getting the autographs. And I don't know there's another situation in the world where that happens.
Yeah.
Given, you know, the red carpet treatment when they're here, and it's just a great feeling of camaraderie amongst the drivers, because they're all from different decades, and yet they all share this common bond that they drove in the 500. Discuss it amongst themselves, and the fans appreciate what they did. But the only people that really know what it's like is the people that did it.
Any piece that you can have of that, it's a little mini fraction, just a morsel of immortality. This is so funny that you say that, because I had never considered that. Oftentimes we'll talk with people who've won it, right? And it changes their lives. It transforms them immediately. Yeah. And for the rest of their life in public, they are introduced as an Indianapolis 500 winner. But to think that even for people who've, I'm sure, right, when you think about it, even if you raced in it once and you got 25th, and then that's still, yeah, that is still, it transforms, you know, who you are too. And of course, if that's your chosen vocation, it's a big deal. And it's
a
big
difference.
Yeah.
I don't know how many fellows have told me. I mean, there wasn't a fan that got out of the grandstands and drove in the race. These are people that drove for years in different disciplines. But Indianapolis, you know, they were able to make it. They drove in it once and finished 25th. It makes a difference. I don't know how many fellows have told me that.
The importance for them personally in their careers, and of course for all those fans through all those decades, cannot be overstated. And for those people who want to get a little bit of something on the online archive that has been curated by Donald Davidson, it is going to be there. We're going to have the link up at WGNradio.com as well for people who want to get information. Get in there. 13 weeks of content highlighting different decades as we lead up into what will be, hopefully, the next Indianapolis 500 coming up in August. So Donald, I can't thank you enough for sharing all this stuff, reminding of us of our DNA that we share with Indy and WGN. And thanks for jumping on the show today.
Well, you're very welcome. And thank you because, you've several things that you said, by golly, you get it. And I appreciate that.
720 WGN. It is Dane here with you high atop Chicago in the Skyline studio, and honored to have on the line with us one of the leading and most influential voices in wine, calling us from Germany's Moselle region in the vineyard that has been in his family's name for over 200 years, the one and only Dr. Ernst Lohsen. Welcome to WGN.
Yes, hello. How you guys doing?
We're doing okay. Well, I mean, in the midst of an apocalyptic pandemic, we're doing as best as we can, and we're making our way through it, due in no small part to the help of you, some of the wine, and some of the things that you're doing. I wanted to ask you, when wine enthusiasts think, at least at first blush, of wine, and they think of some of the more either popular or prominent wine regions, you think of California, or you think of France, or you think of maybe even Australia or some of these other places, but you don't always think of Germany, even though Germany has been one of those top wine producers and some of those best vintages forever. So if you could educate our listeners, all 38 states and Canada of us here tonight, a little bit about Germany and Moselle region and the region where your vineyard is.
Yes. Well, it is, you are absolutely right. It's basically sad that people don't really, associate Germany with wine growing or being a great wine producing country. People know all our cars, you know, yes. Or they know
yes.
Beer and Wurst, you know, and Stein, but they don't associate it with wine. But Germany has a very long tradition of wine growing. It was basically the Romans 2,000 years ago, which brought wine growing to our area. And here in the Mosel, we are the oldest wine growing area of Germany with more than 2,000 years of wine growing tradition. And it is even in a vineyard of us, and one of our vineyards, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, they found an old Roman press house, which is the oldest Roman press house they found in Germany, so 2,000 years old. So from that point of view, we have a long tradition. And if people come to this area and have a lot of visitors coming from all over, and they always say, my God, it's so beautiful here. It's very steep slopes. It's a beautiful valley, river, landscape, you know, no industry, pure nature. And all everybody, if I have visitors coming from the U.S. or from all over the world, they say, my God, we never thought that it is so beautiful here, you know? And man, there's nobody writes about it, you know? From that point of view, it's worth to come.
Ah, well, forget about that, because now the word is out on the street. You know, the reach of what it is that we're doing here, and that there are so many wine enthusiasts in America that are excited to know all about wine, even all about wine in certain areas that have been around for a long time. One of the things that I saw in some of the pictures, and I got to see the seminar that you guys did a couple days ago, is, and you talked about that Roman influence, and it's all over the place in so many different areas and walks of life, is, and you mentioned the slopes. They're more like cliffs, Doctor, because it is, yeah. You have to be very ambitious to grow wine there.
They're insanely steep, these vineyards, you know, insanely steep. But you know what it is? The Romans already found out that the best wine are grown in soils which are extremely poor, where you can't grow anything else, you know, either trees or oil trees, you know, nut trees. And there you can also grow wine. And the wine is so much better if you grow it in soils which are totally unfertile, you know. If you grow wine in fertile soils where you do wheat or corn, that doesn't make great wines. And that's the reason we grow our wines in the very steep slopes, stony, slate soils, you know, and cliff soils. I just bought 2 months ago, the steepest vineyard in the world, you know? it's insane if you go there. What? That is crazy. It's 128% steepness. Crazy.
Oh.
Other people would do mountain climbing there.
No, I'm curious. This is a crazy question. So much about wine is tradition. Of course, you can't get older on the tradition than some of the ways that the Romans have set it up with technology. You know, and you're one of those cutting edge guys. We'll talk about the collaboration with Cooper's Hawk in just a couple of minutes. Has there ever been thought in some of those areas, this is just a crazy question, to utilize drones to do some of the things, maybe for some of the fertilizer or some of the watering, maybe use some of, you know, the drones, you know, where those little mini kind of robot airplanes can help you with the growing?
Well, I mean, we have now, I mean, that is a good thing that technology is going on. And there are, I mean, I tell you, when I started 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it was 100% hand work. It was so labor intense to work these vineyards now. But nowadays, we have certain technology like little crawlers, you know, on a vinge, which can help at least to tie up things in the vineyard. In the old days, we had to schlep everything on our shoulders into the vineyard and to schlep it out of the vineyard. Lots of, when you're having, you know, 100 pounds on your shoulder, yeah, and going a steep vineyard up, you can tell, I tell you, this is exhausting. Now we have little crawlers, which at least transport. It is still exhausting in comparison to vineyards in California, or we have a winery in Oregon that is still much easier. But there are now little machines, which is a huge fortune against 20, 30 years ago. It helps.
Well, you've always been on the cutting edge, 200 years as far as the vineyard being in the family. But yeah, so there's a lot of tradition there, obviously. But even when you came in and took over in 1988, you immediately, you know, started trying to change things and modernize things, and things that I think were really ahead of their time as far as even familiarity or even popularity, whether it was with, you know, organic fertilizers. You changed a lot.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, the funny thing is what I changed was basically only to go back to the tradition, you know. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we thought all we have to be extremely innovative. You know, my father in the 60s, 70s, 80s, I mean, the older schools, they said, oh, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do fertilizer, you have to do new clones, you have to do this and that. And so everybody had been trusting them and had been thought they're very innovative. What I did when I took over, very simple. I have been going back to the winemaking and to the tradition of my great-great-grandfather. And you know why? Because 120 years ago, I thought myself, 120 years ago, the Riesling from Rhine and Mosel had been the most expensive wines in the world. They had been two times more expensive as Chateau Latour, first growth claret, you know? And I said, so these people must have done something right, you know, 120 years ago, you know? Because now we don't have these prices anymore. Nobody wants to drink Riesling. And I thought, let's go back to the winemaking, to the tradition as my great grandfather did it between 1880 and 1930, and let's see. No fertilizers, you know, reduced yields, you know, work with the nature, you know, give the wine the time in the barrel again, no filtration, all these kind of things, you know. Go back to the old times and let the wine ripen in the barrel as they want to do it, and don't force them, you know, to go faster and faster, younger and younger. And, you know, and that was a huge success, you know. People now see, I mean, God, how great the wines used to be. I make wines as it was 120 years ago, and the people now say, oh, my God, that is so great. These old people knew what they did, you know. they should respect them.
Oh, it's so crazy. Because in my mind, I'm thinking, wow, this is so cutting edge and modern, of course. But it's really back to the basics that led to that great foundation that you had in the first place. Now, on the educational side, and you come from a long line of doctors, so there was a lot of learning going into all of that kind of stuff. Is that part of, and here's what you think about it, as you go back, it's not broke, don't fix it, so much tradition, the greatest Rieslings in the world, you're going back to all of that history. But is that whole kind of just, I think, learning in your DNA, is that what caused you to try to travel around the world to all these different wine regions and learn about all different kinds of wine from all over?
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, it's learning by doing, you know? And the funny thing that I have been only going back to the history, you know? But the funny thing, the people thought, oh, this is crazy what this guy is doing. What is he doing? Only because people forgot the history.
Right.
People forgot and ignores the history. They didn't know what the people did 120 years ago. And then they think, oh, this is innovative. You know, I have been only reading. My grandfather has a library of 10,000 books, you know, with old winemaking books from 1817 and so. I have been reading these books, and I said, holy moly, what these guys did there. It's super interesting, you know. Let's try it, you know. Let's do it. And the result, and that is learning by doing. Nobody knew how the wines tasted in these days because they don't exist anymore. And so I did it, learning by doing it, and then see, and the result was amazing, you know. And so I'm so proud that I rediscovered it, you know. And now so many of my colleagues, you know, they copy it and say, yeah, this is a great idea. Well, it's not a great idea. I do only what my grandfather did.
Well, and you've got to give yourself a little bit of credit, too. And one of the great lines that you have and you always have is a great wine begins in your head. And so there are a lot of things that people can do on the tradition side, but also to bring things forward, and not only just on what's in the bottle, but also just bringing it as a great ambassador, not only for Germany, Mosel, Riesling, right? And being that ambassador with America. When you think about tradition, Cooper's Hawk has a tradition that has been built up in a very short period of time, but has impacted so many people and brought so many people to the wine world by just being approachable and open and educational and just for enthusiasts. So talk a little bit about this new wine that you guys have, Trocken. Yeah. It is, I think it breaks a lot of the norms, what people may have thought of Riesling, because it is really, it's an everyday, super refreshing wine. It's really special.
Yes. I mean, you know, I tell you, I was very glad when these kinds approached me, you know, and said, look, we want to do something with you. And these people had also a certain thing in mind, and it is very, very good if the people come to you early, that you can say, okay, let's do something together, because we have to produce the grapes the way, you know. And I mainly also asked them, you guys are open to do something traditional, to go for a traditional dry Riesling from the Mosel, then doing some, implementing some of these old winemaking styles of my grandfather, you know, in the old days, you know. And I said, yeah, that's super interesting. Exactly, that is what we want to do. It was a beautiful collaboration, because a great collaboration works only if you work together, you know. And these people, they have a certain idea, you know, what they want to do. And that was, to work with these people is always, fantastic, you know, because you can do something together. I showed them, look, we can do this and that. And so we introduced some old winemaking techniques by fermenting some full grapes with the wine, you know, to give them more structure. That was pretty much also done in the old days, you know, to keep, I mean, not to ferment only the juice, to keep also 10% of the grapes, you know, in the juice, to ferment the grapes with the juice, you know, to give it more structure, to give it more, you know, mouthfeel and more complexity, you know. And so these guys have been immediately up for these kind of ideas, you know. And I think it's an amazing wine, which we have been making together with these guys, you know. It's a wonderful, wonderful collaboration. These people, I love these people.
Well, and they have so many fans who love them, too, for all those same reasons that you mentioned. And let the listeners know we're talking with the great Dr. Ernst Lohsen, calling us from the Mosel region of Germany. The great winemaking lineage has now, you know, created something brand new, totally different, brand new, and amazing with Cooper's Hawk that reaches, I think their wine club has maybe 500,000 fans that get it every week. They do travel and all that education that goes along with it. But at the DNA, sort of at that ground level, at the core of Cooper's Hawk, and this ties totally in with you, is fun. They really, you know, the wine world can get pretentious and serious at times, and some of the personalities can follow that along, and it shouldn't be that way, right? It's all about, wine is about bringing people together, and you guys coming together. Yeah. Talk a little bit about, like, our mutual friend Tim McHenry, like, just that personality wise he loves you and what you do, and it's really worked out.
Yes, well, he visited me, and we came together. We visited the vineyard. And we tasted the wine with the food. I showed him the wine. You know, I mean, such a plant is always a plant from different components, you know, from soil. This is a typical soil from the area, you know. And as I said, barrels which made in the very traditional style. And so I think it was a great, great, great visit, work together, which is very important that somebody is coming over. Thanks God it was before Corona. and so that you work really physically together, you know, that it is not only an idea, you know, and kind of, can you do something for me? No, it was a very a physical working together, you know. That makes it so amazing, you know, that there is something, you know, they're coming also two ideas together, you know.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of wine fans are going to be introduced to Trocken as they visit their Cooper's Hawker online and all that kind of stuff. Go ahead.
I was also very happy that they choose a Trocken. Trocken means dry.
Yes.
It's a dry version, you know, because, you know, that there was always a reputation of Riesling is cheap and sweet, you know. No, it was traditionally dry. No, the tradition was always dry, and the German name is Trocken. So I was especially honored and very happy that the people said, no, we want to go for this tradition. We want to go for a dry Riesling. Mm. We want to introduce to the people the Riesling as it used to be, you know. It was not historically sweet and cheap. It was historically dry and super expensive. And that was the crazy thing, that they immediately said, look, we want to go. We don't want to go for mainstream. We want to go for the tradition. We want to show the people how great a Riesling can be in the dry style.
Oh, no, Dr. Loesen, I don't want to be your consultant on the marketing side, but dry is great. But dry and super expensive might not be the best marketing slogan, but I know that people are going to love it. And of course, it has redefined what Riesling kind of means and what it is. And I think the words are what are refreshing. I think you've said that with this, and I don't know, it's great with food. It really pairs. And so let's hear a little bit about that. But also, it's just one of those things that you, I think in one of the seminars, you had mentioned that you can drink Trocken to like drink yourself sober, right? Where it's more refreshing than it is heavy.
Yes, because it is a grape variety. Riesling is a grape variety which doesn't need to be high in alcohol. It performs with low alcohol, you know. You can make a great dry wine with 11.5-12% alcohol, no? And it is perfect. It's beautiful. It's versatile. And it doesn't mean dry, it doesn't mean it is austere. A Riesling dry, even with low alcohol, it can be fruit-driven, you know. It can have wonderful stone fruit. It can be beautiful, you know, and round and so, you know. And this makes Riesling so magic. It is not high in alcohol. It's versatile. It's still fruit-driven. And that makes it so versatile for all kind of food. I always say, if you don't know what to choose, you know, if you don't know what you want to drink, which wine you want to drink with your food, a dry Riesling, you know, works always.
Yeah, and for Cooper's Hawk fans, the soy ginger salmon is great with it. Ellie's chicken piccata. There's so many dishes that they'll enjoy. We'll have links up at WGNradio.com all about this and for people to get in on that. And we may even have a bottle for one of the listeners.
And you know what? If everybody has the chance, this is for me the most amazing combination with a dry Riesling. It's ceviche. Ceviche and dry Riesling is for me personally the most ideal combination. It's so interesting. I recommend to everybody, if you have a ceviche and dry Riesling, try first the Riesling, then taste the ceviche, and then taste the Riesling. There's no other combination where you see how much a wine change if you eat a bite of the ceviche and then drink the wine, how different the wine is then to the wine when you tasted it beforehand. Oh. It gets so much richer and more aromatic. It's amazing. For me, I mean, ceviche and dry Riesling. Everybody has to do it at once in his life.
We're going to try that today. So that's a little bit of advice, a little bit. It brings with it all of that history, the tradition, the inspiration, and of course, the fun that you bring with it, Dr. Loesen, as well. So as we let you go, if there's any way for listeners, is there a website or social media or places where they can keep up with all your adventures?
Oh, yes. You go on the drloesen.com. You know, website, you know, Dr. Loesen, put Dr. Loesen on the webpage, our webpage.com is popping up, and there's all these kind of different, you know, ventures we have. We're doing a Riesling in Washington State with Chateau Saint-Michel. We're doing Riesling in Oregon, you know, and we all there introduced this historic winemaking of my grandfather, and it's amazing. It also works in the new world, this old historic winemaking.
Congratulations with all the success, of course, and congratulations on the collaboration. Everything that is old is new and amazing again. And so, Dr. Loesen, thanks for everything you're doing. Thanks for jumping on the show tonight.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. And always have a glass of Riesling in mind.
720 WGN, high atop Chicago in the Skyline Studio, and honored to have best-selling author of the books Awakened the brink, and now obliteration. Millions of fans know and love him as one of the stars of the hit TV show Impractical Jokers on True TV, Misery Index on TBS, sold out comedy tours around the country. He is, as we like to say on the show, he's the thinking man's Joker, the one and only, and author, James S. Murray. Murray, welcome to WGN.
What's happening, Dan? Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's great to have. It's always great to have you on. And
I love coming on this show.
Yeah, well, no, we appreciate it. Chicago loves you too. Now you're at this point in your kind of journey through stardom. I'm not sure, Mer. You know, you've always been one of the more grounded people, more humble. You guys are all humble, really. But are you into that jaded and cynical standpoint in your career yet, where you're just dismissive of your legions of fans?
No, man. I get to make my best friends laugh for a living. I get to embarrass my best friends on for a living. That's pretty good, man. That doesn't get old. I don't get tired of that ever.
you know what? Now, here's the thing, too, is that Jokers, as much as that is how people identify you, and rightly so, it's been such a huge hit, but it doesn't necessarily define you. It never did. And so with the books, you know, to have it was, you know, originally a multi-book series. You know, you haven't always hit home runs with everything coming up in the career, right? It just depends on the nature of who's looking at it and, you know, the climate and all that kind of stuff. Was there any thought, like, making it a multi kind of series book, that if Awakened wasn't like the huge hit that it was, that the rest of the story might not be told doing it in three parts?
I mean, I wrote the first book, Awakened, 16 years ago, long before Jokers, and I couldn't get anybody to read it, you know, and I had to get on TV and our amazing fans and how supportive they are, everything we do. I was able to get HarperCollins to buy the book, and it did really well. It hit like number one on the UK Sunday Times and all sorts of bestsellers around the world. And then they bought the trilogy. So the new one is Obliteration. You don't have to have read the first two books to know what happens in Obliteration. We catch you right up. It is awesome. It's like, it really is kind of like a dream come true, first of all, to pull off a trilogy. It's really hard, you know? And I think we did it, man. I think we stuck the landing. It's exciting, fast-paced, action-packed. It's like the perfect summer reading you'll ever have.
Now, the topic, you know, science fiction, alien, you know, apocalypse, it's always cool. It's a fascinating topic. But here's this, and outside of the stardom, because there's some that can be attached, like, oh, well, that's Murr. We love everything he does. But as a book, it has been acclaimed, you know, high praise from people like Brad Meltzer, who we love. Like, what does it feel like to actually be, I mean, you can't, whatever the guys say and whatever they may, you know, whatever, like, you are a legitimate author with actual best-selling books that stand on their own.
That's pretty cool, man. I always dreamt of doing it, you know, but the guys and I have failed so much more in our careers than we succeeded, you know, like it took us 11 years to get on TV, you know, and we, I guess what we're saying is like being hard at stuff and failing until I succeed. And none of it would be possible without our fan base and how supportive they are, you know? So like all these good things that happen, like our tour and these books and Sal's stand up and Q's Beer Company and Joe's charity work, all these amazing things are entirely because of our fan base and how supportive they are of us. So
has that been part of it, is where, you know, you guys sit back, and especially at times like this when there's a lot of things that you can't do, you know, as far as the touring and the appearance, where you've had maybe moments during this pandemic time to kind of sit back and say, you know what, we've achieved a level of success, and you've mentioned it, where you've got fans who understand who you guys are individually, what it is that you guys can do, where you've been able to say, you know, I always wanted to do blank. Is that what, have all you guys been doing that?
I think so. I mean, we've done a couple of things while on lockdown. You know, we created a new show called Impractical Jokers Dinner Party, which is the guys and I having together on Zoom. It airs on Thursday nights. It is so much fun. It's like hanging out with the guys and I in our homes, you know, on TV. Yeah. And then, of course, we have the Misery Index on TBS. And we're going to start back into production on Jokers real soon. So we're excited for that. But yeah, I've been, you know, writing books. I'm literally have a book in front of me right now, a new one that comes out in October called Don't Move.
Whoa.
And we're writing another one, comes out next April, called The Stowaway. So I've been doing a lot of that. I've been planning my wedding.
Man.
I get married in less than 2 months. So
Wow. Well, okay. Well, congratulations. Now, how are you going to do that? So we've got our niece is getting married. She had it planned for, you know, a year or so, but now because of the pandemic, everything's been pared down. So it went from 200 people to like 40 people. And now it's all different. Have you, because of the obvious, you know, weight and power of your success, are you able to just, you know, wash away the rules and regulate? Are you guys going to have like a cool big wedding, or is it going to be more intimate friends, family, just you guys?
We cut the list into a third. So we originally had like close to 300 people. Now it's at barely 100, and we'll see how many of those actually come. But the invites literally went out this week. But yeah, so I got to get rid of all the BS like fourth and fifth cousins.
it's the greatest excuse.
Pretty good.
I mean, it's like to keep you safe, man. It's not because you're not important. You are.
Fifth cousin, you know, cousin Catherine, who I've never met. I'm sorry. It's just to keep you and your family safe.
you're doing the people's work. Because you wanted to ask, too, is like when it comes to some of the projects and things that you're doing for years before Impractical Jokers and all that kind of success, you were always writing. You were always like pitching shows. And of course, you know, from the show, have some of those projects have been highlighted, like Damned, right? You know, that's the kind of thing that may not happen. But one of the things that was actually part of like a joke at your expense was, I can't remember the name of it, but it was a game show concept. When I first saw it, I'm like, you know, that actually would work. It was like Monumental Challenge or something, right?
Where
it was
my
like,
friend, let me tell you, did the guys make fun of me on the TV show? I used to work in TV development for a long time. For 10 years, I was the head of development for the company that makes Jokers. And that's how we sold Jokers through my job. I pitched it and sold it, right? So I will tell you, one day I'm going to sell that show, Monumental Challenge, because it holds the record still to this day as being the only TV show at that company that we've developed that has gone to green light meeting at four different networks. Meaning that four different networks, it got right to the top with budget and schedule submitted and was at the green light meeting and didn't go to series. Four times. Four different networks. And that means we're awfully close.
Well, and I think, too, it just stands on its own. Outside of all the great joking and the fun that we have with it, it just makes sense. I think it would work. Now, here, we want to, of course, let the listeners know we're talking with James S. Murray, acclaimed best-selling international author, and, of course, the thinking man's Joker, Murr. Is there any thought to, like, being more of like a Merv Griffin type? Because I think at some point, and you can let the listeners know, at what point when you were actually filming Jokers, did it really become untenable? Maybe three out of four people that were there like actually recognize you, where you have to kind of extend it out. So maybe this is a game show. Maybe you're not in it, right? You just are the one kind of running it.
Yeah, but I was in the pilot episode. I was, this is before Jokers, but I was in the pilot episode. And I think one day I will be in the series of it when many years after Jokers ends, I could see myself going back to this show.
Well, the writing is something. The TV pitching is one thing, certainly got experience, but the writing is something that you're doing and doing at a high level. We brought up a minute ago about the wedding, you know, and that kind of sense, you know, you're also a romantic guy, obviously, after at some point. So the alien apocalypse and, you know, just the destruction of the planet and all that kind of stuff in the first series. Do you have sort of a Nicholas Sparks side to you? Are we going to see sort of a romantic book from a James S. Murray?
You know, like a love story. Yeah. I will tell you, there is a fair amount of fan fiction, like romantic fan fiction on the internet about Impractical Jokers. And if you haven't had the chance, I highly encourage you to seek it out and find it on Google. It is hysterically funny. It usually winds up being like Sal and me end up falling in love or something like that. It's so funny. Like, and the characters they write for us are hysterical. So if you want some good romantic comedy, look up fan fiction for Impractical Jokers. Will I ever write a rom-com one day? I don't know, maybe. We'll see. For now, I'm sticking with thrillers and horror.
Well, for the people who get all of their information and their trusted source for knowledge is Wikipedia, it actually still says that you're married to Sal's sister. So, yeah. And I guess technically
you were. Please don't tell my fiancé that.
Yeah. If you had to explain it. So going forward, is there any thoughts, too? Because you're always thinking a few, you know, steps ahead. Like, this book is out, highly acclaimed. It's going to be, you know, probably the biggest seller based on the success of the past ones. You guys have already done a movie. Not to say it has to be a Joker's movie, but for maybe a movie around the books. I mean, that whole genre with the, you know, the aliens and, you know, the Earth and, you know, all that stuff, not only relevant because we're living in sort of an apocalyptic situation today, but in general, that style of movie is really popular. Any thoughts? Are you guys planning a movie for the books?
That is always the plan. Literally yesterday afternoon, we had a conference call developing Don't Move, which is the new thriller that comes out in October. developing it as a movie, no joke, and pitching and selling it as a movie. So that is always the plan. And we write the books like Obliteration, Don't Move. These books are highly, highly visual. They read like an action movie. Like, it's the kind of book you can't put down. You flip from page to page to page, and it just sucks you right in. And you just are invested in the characters. The story is relentless and compelling and interesting. And it's perfect to be adapted into a movie.
And now you have the support and the budget behind it, so you're not left like you were with Damned, right? You only had one car to sell in order to make the movie. Now you can do all the special effects. You can have cameos by famous actors. You could do it all.
You know, the Joker's movie was an interesting test of all that. I hope you guys have seen it.
Yeah, of course.
Rent it or download it now. I think we were actually, somebody was telling me the other day, I think we were the last movie to come out in theaters before the theater shut down.
Yeah.
And we were only in theaters for like 2 weeks before everything shut. So there is a chance, because of Forfeit, that we will be the highest grossing comedy of 2020.
Who cares?
And also, there's a chance that come the Academy Awards, in a normal year, we would never, ever, ever win an Academy Award. But since we're the last, since we came out of February and everything else shut down, we might win.
Oh my gosh.
Best comedy, best film, best foreign film, best animated feature, best actor, best support. Who knows? We might win the whole Academy Award.
So are you already planning? Obviously, you guys, especially Joe with the pets and everything, you got to make a social difference. Are you already planning your speech out, to make that impactful social statement from the platform of the Jokers?
I have not started writing that, nor will I.
Well, I got to tell you, and one of the last things is that our family, we watch the shows. Obviously, you know that. We've seen the live performances, and we've watched the movies. We'd buy a Murr action figure if it was available. And so are you surprised, like, with all of the stuff? I'm sure some of the people that are buying the books and kind of bringing to the success, I'm sure many of them are Impractical Joker fans. There may be a time, Murr, where you kind of transcend into Paul Newman territory, where people just think of you as the salad dressing guy. They think of you only as an author and not necessarily the Impractical Jokers. But are you surprised as far as just the range of people who love what it is you guys do?
There's so many parts of that question I want to talk about. Do you know, by the way, do you know how much money Paul Newman has donated to charity because of the salad dressing and all the brands that his corporation owns?
It's lots. I mean, millions and millions.
It is. You're ready for this? It's over $500 million.
Whoa.
Since its inception, whenever he started it like 30 years ago. Isn't that crazy? We were just looking. It's my favorite dressing. I was just looking up the stats literally about 3 weeks ago. Over $500 million. It's crazy, right? Anyways.
Well, and the impact that he had with it, because I have talked to some people who are a little bit younger, maybe not as familiar with his acting career, legendary actor, and this is legitimate, and I was shocked, had to step back, that they only knew him as the salad dressing guy.
The salad dressing guy. There you go. If I can, I wonder what they'll think of me as, the bald guy,
no.
The ferret tattoo.
Oh, my gosh.
The guy that got thrown out of an airplane. I don't know, the guy with the driver's license with sheep dogs. I don't know.
Pet cremation, grandparent divorce advocate. You never know. Like,
ferret guy. I don't know.
Well, I was thinking more from as your momentarily career consultant, I was thinking of international best-selling author, right? And they're like, oh, yeah, but he also has a sense of humor. I did not know that. And they would say,
you know what? As Walt Whitman once said, I am large. I contain multitudes. So there you go.
That's right. One thing does not define you. So as we let you go, for people who want to keep up with all your adventures, obviously all those different ways that they can enjoy what it is that you and you guys do on TV for the bookstores, your local bookstore, when they open. And until then, Amazon will drop it off to you on social media. Murr, where can people keep up with you?
Go pick up Obliteration. You will not be disappointed. It'll be the best summer reading you'll ever have. Obliteration, anywhere books are sold online. Of course, you can pre-order Don't Move, our new thriller coming out this fall, anywhere books are sold as well.
James S. Murray, the one and only Murr from Impractical Jokers, and of course, behind all those best-selling books. Thanks for everything that you're doing. Thanks for jumping on the show today.
You got it. Thanks for having me.